Thank you, Nick. The time is approaching 10 o'clock and beady eyes will be focused upon events in committee where the vetting or the unvetting or the failed vetting of Peter Mandelson continues to concern. Aggie Chambro keeping a close eye on that on your behalf, and we'll be catching up with her through the course of this morning. But we begin, as we must, on the other side of the Atlantic with fairly hideous images of Donald Trump trying to inflict his ludicrous beta male handshake upon King Charles, and King Charles gamely refusing to be cowed. That, at least, is how it looked to me. Do we know why he's there? Do we want to have a crack at that? Poor chap.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, Kemi Badenoch has told LBC the Prime Minister is scared he won't survive a parliamentary inquiry into the Lord Mandelson vetting row. The Conservative leader says Sir Keir Starmer is forcing his MPs to back him in a vote on it later.
A privileges committee is not a massive inquiry. It's a handful of MPs. It has a majority of Labour MPs on it, and they are still scared to send this to the committee. That can only be because they know it will likely find him guilty.
The Prime Minister says he did not mislead MPs and is urging his backbenchers to stand together on the issue. The King and Queen were greeted by Donald Trump and the First Lady at the White House at the start of their US state visits. Uniformed Secret Service personnel far outnumbered members of the public days after an attempted assassination on the US President. King Charles is due to make an address to Congress later, where he's expected to praise the UK-US relationship. The Education Secretary has told LBC the government won't U-turn on plans for social media for under-16s. Bridget Phillipson has said there could still be a full ban on the way, depending on the outcome of a consultation. The head of the RMT union has told LBC reports of looming nationwide strike action are overblown. Eddie Dempsey has been speaking at a rally in Glasgow. It had been claimed threats of mass walkouts are being made as talks over new pay deals continue.
It's overblown. We're in negotiations on pay. It's the usual... certain elements of the right-wing press trying to make excitable headlines. The simple fact is we're in negotiations with pay with the train operating companies. We've already settled pay in London Underground. We've already settled pay in Network Rail, and we're expecting similar offers for the TOCs. We're in negotiations. We're expecting those offers to come through fairly soon.
And BP's profits have more than doubled in the first 3 months of this year because of the war in Iran. The conflict began at the end of February, leading to a huge surge in oil prices. The company made £2.4 billion between January and March, much higher than analysts had expected. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 21 points at 10,341. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, a cloudy morning across England and Wales with some scattered showers. Sunshine in Scotland and Northern Ireland with a high of 20 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Minutes after 10 is the time. A very good morning to you. I wonder whether we can conduct conversations at moments like this in the way that we used to. It would once have been a fairly reliable presumption that we had almost all seen some of the footage of the King and Queen arriving in the United States of America to be greeted by Donald Trump and his wife. But I don't think that's true anymore, is it? People derive their news from so many different places. So much of it is from social media, which is, of course, algorithmed into feeding extant appetites. So it's not as if everybody watched the 9 o'clock or the 10 o'clock news last night and therefore saw the state visit with whoever is the latter-day equivalent of Nicholas Witchell pontificating on the importance of the visit. And do you know, isn't it odd that we are probably one of the greatest constants in the UK media? I've never noticed that before. I've never noticed that before. Newspaper circulation continues to plummet. Television news programmes are nowhere near the required viewing that they used to be. You've got more noses in the trough fighting for fewer and fewer eyes. And we continue to rise. We continue to go up. We haven't changed much over the years. We still deal in more or less the same stuff. We talk about the news. You give me a ring. I have a chat with you. You move along. Someone else comes on. It's really weird. I've never actually spotted that before. News media in particular is in an extraordinary state of flux and largely decline. And yet here we are still doing what we do. But doing it, I suppose, in slightly different ways, because I would once, when I started here, have been fairly confident that we would all have seen or listened to some fairly hefty chunks of this visit. The first official visit to the United States since the last Queen's in 2007. They have made yesterday's show entirely redundant. I don't know if you were listening yesterday. Would you like to know a secret? It's a very different phone-in when you are speculating on something that's going to happen than it is when you are talking about something that has happened or is happening. I haven't mastered the art of selling the speculative to you. Even after all these years, I haven't quite mastered the art of selling the speculative. In other words, what do you think of this thing that is about to happen? Eleanor very kindly points out that it's possible nobody has actually mastered the art of selling the speculative, but you know how my brain works. I take that as a challenge. Although I am reminded of a conversation I had with Joseph Heller many years ago, the author of Catch 22, when someone I was with, I don't think it was me, but it was a while ago, asked him how he felt about the fact that none of his subsequent books had done as well or were as good as his breakthrough novel Catch 22, to which Joseph Heller replied something along, well, nobody else has written one as good as that either, so why should I beat myself up, which I always thought was a wonderful response. I don't think he was unveiling it for the first time when I was in his hallowed presence, but I'd never mastered the art of selling you the speculative. I don't know why I'm mentioning that, just that today we have now seen things happening, and it occurred to me that we can't be as confident that we will all have seen them as I would have been once. So let me tell you what I have seen. I have seen, I think, Donald Trump trying to do that thing that pathetic men through the ages have always done, which is to sort of translate some sort of physical supremacy into a handshake. And two, you know, however you cut it, two very old men, one of whom has been treated for cancer, and one of them trying to sort of intimidate the other by doing that mad sort of handshake. Do you remember? I saw it on some dreadful program like, I don't know, The Apprentice or something a million years ago. You turn your hand over when you're shaking hands with someone to establish dominance. I mean, you'd do the opposite, wouldn't you? You'd just establish a word I can't say on the radio, unfortunately, but you just establish the fact that you were one of them if you were doing that. So Trump obviously got it programmed into him many, many years ago to do that, establish your dominance in a handshake. And the king, if you watch it, the footage that I'm referring to, the king appears to resist, to sort of give it the whole, no, I'm not stepping back or turning my head. Anyway, that's one of the things that I have seen. The way in which they have made yesterday's show entirely redundant is by revealing after we came off air that they will not be having a kind of public, what do you call it? It's not quite a press conference, but there won't be any opportunity for the king to humiliate for the president to humiliate the king. And that's what I mean about the difficulty in selling you a speculative conversation as opposed to an analytical one. It didn't cross my mind yesterday that the concerns, the obvious concerns about Donald Trump doing something entirely inappropriate or entirely wrong would be mitigated by not actually having any moments where they were speaking ad lib, as it were, in the presence of the cronies and cretins that surround the president. And crucially, the world's television cameras. So they have done that. If you, again, you may have missed this. They have made the decision not to have any press conference style encounter where Donald Trump would be able to say something entirely inappropriate about Diana, Princess of Wales, about Prince Harry, probably more likely about Keir Starmer, who knows what he would do, because absolutely anything is possible with this character. But they have made the decision not to have any cameras at Trump's meeting with the King. One newspaper reports it this morning. King Charles will be spared the potential humiliation of being upbraided in public by Donald Trump during his state visit after the White House agreed that any meeting between the two men should be held off camera. So there goes yesterday's phone-in about what's the worst thing that can happen or the best thing that could happen in the context of that meeting in front of cameras. We've had a sort of early heads up on what the speech that the King is scheduled to give to Congress later today is going to contain. And it seems to be stressing that time and again our two countries have always found ways to come together. You can also expect him to express sympathy for the attack in the hotel on Saturday night, but it is references probably to great international challenges and the importance of standing together to defend democratic values that could be read as quite coded. He will call, we are told, for reconciliation and renewal of the US and UK partnership, and possibly reference both NATO and the protection of Ukraine, which is a potentially controversial point, given that Donald Trump has made no secret of his contempt for Ukraine and its leader, and indeed his contempt for NATO. The speech is written on the advice of the government. I don't know whether that quite means it is written by the government. I suspect that some of the King's people will be involved in the process, and it will be a sort of speech by committee, and it will be delivered to Congress, and that will be a moment, one that we haven't seen for the best part of 20 years in the context of a UK monarch. But what's the point? What is the point of all this? Seriously. Why is he there? Why is the King there? I know it's the 250th anniversary of US independence, but that oddly doesn't seem to be a massive part of the scheduling. I'm sure there'll be a visit to a military base, or they would have landed in a military base, wouldn't they? There doesn't appear to be a great deal of pageantry or celebration of the 250th anniversary of independence. So, I mean, even if there were, the likelihood of it buttering any parsnips with Donald Trump is pretty slim, isn't it? So why is he there? 12 minutes after 10 is the time. You have a variety of scenarios that could have played out publicly, but it's they're not going to arise. He's going to deliver a speech to Congress that will be, by definition and by diplomatic demand, relatively anodyne. And if you could get Keir Starmer in the room and distract him briefly from the continuing quizzing of senior civil servants by Emily Thornberry at the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, Aggie Chambray will be joining us later to talk about that, and you could ask him why the King has gone, what do you think he would say? Should we start with that question? So I'm interested in why you think he's gone, but let's start with, because this is all on Keir Starmer. This, as I alluded to yesterday, I don't think that the Dimbleby would have been activated without approval from on high, and they or he was speaking about the whole undertaking being ill-advised because Donald Trump is such a is Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is Donald Trump. So you're exposing the King to potential diplomatic disaster, potential humiliation. I think we had one caller yesterday who questioned that, but I think the fact that they've now agreed to conduct the conversations in private rather gives the lie to the idea that the King could have expected any special treatment from Donald Trump on due to his special status or something like that. They are conducting conversations in private and away from cameras in order to spare the king the potential humiliation that Donald Trump might either deliberately or accidentally expose him to. And then you'll get the 20-minute speech to Congress. I don't even know how big a deal this is in the United States. Do you? Is this on the front page of the Washington Post? Is it on the front page of the New York Times? It seems unlikely to me that the special relationship is as special on that side of the Atlantic as it is on this one. But when I ask you this question, I want you to take a moment and then put together your answer. If Keir Starmer was here now, and we said to him, why have you sent the king to Washington? Probably, or possibly, or perhaps, whichever P word you prefer, against his will, why have you done it? Why has Keir Starmer sent the king to Washington? And you can do that either in your own words or in an idea about what Keir Starmer would say if we were to put the question to him. It's 10:15. I'm going to hit the numbers now. 0345 6060973 is the number that you need. What actual rationale is there for this trip? It might be different now from what it was when it was announced, but I actually found myself unable this morning to answer the question of what he's actually doing there, because an awful lot of the answers that might immediately suggest themselves in that space don't actually make sense when you remember who it is that we're dealing with. So why has the king gone to America and to the United States? And crucially, what does Keir Starmer think is likely to be achieved? 0345 6060973 is the number that you need. I sort of assemble as many answers as possible on this one. Why is he there? In your own words, what is Keir Starmer hoping to achieve? Also in your own words, that's how speaking works. But in your imaginings of what Keir Starmer would say if we could administer a truth serum and ask him what on earth he's playing at. It's 10:16.
LBC.
With an Amex business card, Selena's earning points renovating her skin clinic and refreshing the builders.
14 coffees and 28 sugars, please.
And on new adjustable chairs for every room. And she can use the points to lie back and relax.
Don't put ice cream on your brother's head.
Well, sometimes. And that's because with an Amex business card, your points can go towards holidays and more.
Search Amex business card. Interest fees and terms apply. Available to UK limited companies and limited liability partnerships. Signatories must be a director or member of the business. Subject to approval.
One of the best things about a holiday with Saga is your chauffeur who'll pick you up and drive you to your departure point. Whether you're river cruising along the Rhine. Or uncovering centuries of history on a tour of Japan. Even better, they'll pick you up and drive you home again afterwards. 2027 season now on sale. Search Saga Holidays. Experience is everything. Nationwide chauffeur service available on UK mainland. Full terms apply. Over 50s only. Atoll protected.
It's that summer escape kind of feeling. As everyone finds their happy place. A celebratory drink. A taste of something new. A quiet retreat to the lounge. Because with P&O Ferries, that holiday feeling doesn't wait until you arrive. It starts the moment you step on board. P&O Ferries from Dover to Calais. Summer's calling. Book now at poferries.com. Travel without the travel.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
It is 18 minutes after 10, and it's a trip that must have been undertaken with a very, very heavy heart by the king and his wife, the king and the queen. What on earth is the point of it? What on earth is hoped will be achieved? What is the rationale behind Keir Starmer's decision to, I suspect, against the king's will, insist that he undertakes this trip to the White House? The other story from the sort of Trump land that I am interested by is this one about them demanding that a comedian be cancelled for making a joke. This is from the wife of a man who greeted the death of Robert Mueller. I don't know if you're aware that Robert Mueller was the recipient of both a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star for heroism in the service of his country. But when he died, Donald Trump announced, "I'm glad he's dead." Jimmy Kimmel made a joke on late night television about the fact that because Donald Trump is so much older than his wife, she's likely to be a widow sooner rather than later. He made that before the events of Saturday night for the avoidance of any doubt. Melania Trump has broken cover to demand that Jimmy Kimmel be fired. I couldn't see a way into that as a conversation except to ask what on earth could possibly explain such extraordinary levels of hypocrisy and self-deception. But we may find a way to nibble away at that later in the hour as well. But first, on this question of why on earth has he gone? Simon is in Preston. Simon, what would you like to say?
Hello, James.
Hello,
first
Simon.
Of all, thank you for not doing the teeny tiny violin, which put me off last time.
What was that? With regards to...
You had a teeny tiny violin moment.
Oh, my noise. No, that was a horrible noise. I don't think I'm going to inflict that on anybody ever again. I do apologise.
Good, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Anyway, just a quick point. I feel deeply uncomfortable with it all. I really don't see the point because there's a real conflict of interest with Prince Charles with his own family connection with Jeffrey Epstein and obviously Trump's connection with Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah.
But also as well, I'm rather glad that we've fallen out with somebody stood up to Trump and actually called him out for what he is. So I don't see the point. And it just puts King Charles, it must be very difficult having to sit with that fool.
I'm not a massive fan of opening up the phone lines and asking people how they feel. I don't know why. It's probably something I need to work on. But it's interesting that's the first thing you said, because I nearly did today. How does it make you feel? And it makes me feel ever so slightly, I think soiled is too strong a word, but I feel very cringy, as the kids, or cringe, I think the kids say. They don't add an E on.
And
that is because he is such a sort of disreputable character.
Person. He's so cringeworthy.
Yes.
He's beyond cringe. He's beyond cringe.
And if we had Starmer in the room and we said, "Why have you made him go?" what would he say?
I think probably...
Demeaned is a good word, isn't it? Demeaned. The king is demeaned.
Can you try and wiggle your way back, get us back in so we're on speaking terms or something? I don't know. I'm very disappointed with Keir Starmer at the moment.
Yeah, a lot of people are. And I mean, it's amazing how
I stuck up for him last time. Last time I phoned up, I said I'd stuck up for him. But again, he's let himself go with this dreadful business that rumbles on and on and on.
And it's rumbling on as we speak, actually. We'll be catching up on those latest rumblings a little later this hour. Let's add that question to the list. Not just what word would you use, but why has Keir Starmer done it when it feels so demeaning? It's all very well saying he's not shaking hands with Donald Trump. He's shaking hands with the office of the United States president, the president of the United States of America. But he is shaking hands with Donald Trump. Rebecca uses the word the ick. It gives you the ick. It does, doesn't it? And that all adds to the power, really, of the question of why on earth Keir Starmer is doing this. Why has Keir Starmer sent the king to undertake this demeaning exercise? 22 minutes after 10 is the time. Josh is in Scarborough. Josh, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Morning. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. What's on your mind?
I'm just thinking about what Starmer would say, effectively. And my kind of view is just like, I've got no other options. It's kind of the stasis where we sent Mandelson to do like the dirty dog version of trying to get in and get into Trump's level.
Yes.
He's tried it himself to go there. And that really didn't get us very far, you know, the old dropping of the papers, and he looked, you know...
Actually. It was a brilliant... I mean, it was widely regarded as a glorious... This is what I meant a minute ago when I talked about how far and how fast the pendulum swings. When he announced the state visit and Trump was like, you know, wagging his tail, and he was absolutely delighted with it, and Starmer, we thought, was playing him like an old piano, and it fell apart relatively quickly, but that visit was a success. The fact that it fell apart relatively quickly adds to the confusion about why they've decided to roll this particular dice again.
Yeah, I think they rolled it. Literally, it was just a case of we've tried the middle ground, we've tried the low ball in, and now we have to go into a top ground.
Why do we have to?
I'll never understand the special relationship thing myself. I mean, I don't think it's viewed that special from across the pond, to be honest with you. I'm not from across there, so I wouldn't know. Really.
No, I don't think it is either. I mean, obviously there's history involved, and there's a degree of reverence, oddly, for royalty, given that they dispensed with it. But there's not anything like the sort of, well, there's no dependence, is there? It's not a symbiotic relationship.
And as well, it's obviously, you know, the whole, it's 250 years of being independent. It's like, well why would you go over there? Yeah, well done. It's like, yeah, you've been away from us for 250 years. Why would you want to celebrate that by bringing our king over and being like, look what we've done without you, kind of thing? It doesn't make sense to me.
How demeaning, I like this word, demeaning. How demeaning is it for the king to be? And this is what I think perhaps his allies in the media who were clearly given permission to speak up. This is what I think they were concerned about. You know, he's a dignified man, albeit that he's imperfect and he will carry a lot of our opinions of royalty in general. It's demeaning to see him and his wife having to cozy up to these characters.
I don't think it's going to be demeaning, to be honest with you. I think that, like I say, it's our kind of last attempt because
that's where it all falls apart, isn't it? In that you're trying to appease someone who is unappeasable, and even if he is, you know, all jolly hockey sticks, at some point in the next 3 days, then on day four he could return to a position of contempt and hideous abuse of our democratically elected Prime Minister. 10:25 is the time. Why is he there? 03456060973 is the number you need. And you've got that sort of parallel mystery at the moment. J.D. Vance coming over to Europe to announce that we don't have any free speech, while the President and his wife are calling for a comedian to be sacked for making a sort of half-decent joke about the age gap that exists between the President and his wife. There's a few mentions of Epstein. Simon Marks played us a little clip yesterday that has, it kind of stayed with me a bit in the way that clips sometimes do, in that I don't know what a psychologist would make of this, but he's subsequently come out and attacked the woman asking this question about the reasons given by the shooter in Washington for undertaking the actions that he appears to have undertaken. The idea that a journalist would not speak about a criminal's or a suspect's or a terrorist's manifesto when the manifesto was in the public place, was in the public space, is absolutely unthinkable. I mean, it would be literally like sitting down with a politician and not asking them what their policies were. So you sit down with someone who has been the target, apparently, of an attack, or the people around him have been the targets of attack, and you say, look, here are some of the reasons given by the guy who did it. What do you think about that? But referring back to what I said a moment ago at the top of the show about no longer being confident that everybody is watching the same news or everybody is getting the same footage in front of them. This is worth hearing again. Nora O'Donnell, the CBS journalist who has come in latterly for hideous personal and misogynistic abuse from Trump, in an interview on CBS 60 Minutes that Simon Marks brought to our attention yesterday.
He also wrote this: I'm no longer willing to permit a pedophile, rapist, and traitor to coat my hands with his crimes. What's your reaction
to
that?
Well, I was waiting for you to read that because I knew you would, because You're horrible people. Horrible people. Yeah, he did write that. I'm not a rapist. I didn't rape anybody.
Do you think he was referring to you?
Excuse me. I'm not a pedophile. You read that crap from some sick person. I got associated with all stuff that has nothing to do with me. I was totally exonerated. Your friends on the other side of the plate are the ones that were involved with, let's say, Epstein or other things. But I said to myself, you know, I'll do this interview and they'll probably, I read the manifesto, you know, he's a sick person, but you should be ashamed of yourself reading that, because I'm not any of those things.
Mr. President, and I was never,
excuse me, you shouldn't be reading that on 60 Minutes. You're a disgrace. But go ahead, let's finish the interview.
I mean, they are the gunman's words. I play that because it tallies a little bit, ties in with the Jimmy Kimmel conversation, and adds to this sense that the king has been sent into a situation that is just really unseemly, demeaning, sleazy, having to treat these people with respect. Trump sued a woman, for the record, who accused him of rape for libel, and lost. Make of that what you will. There's a lot of semantic to-ing and fro-ing in some ways, influenced by Donald Trump's litigious nature. But those are the facts of the matter. A woman accused him of rape. He sued her for libel. He lost. She won. And that Jimmy Kimmel thing, trying to silence even jokes now. There is an air here. And of course, accusing the other side of doing what you're doing yourself. Oh, you've got no free speech in the United Kingdom. Have you been to a Jimmy Carr concert? Have you watched the Netflix specials that British comedians do? Have you seen Ricky Gervais recently? Our comedians can say pretty much whatever they want. Even, and sometimes especially when it upsets others. You're calling for Jimmy Kimmel to be cancelled simply for making a joke about the age gap between the president and his wife. So you can't talk about what the gunman said. You can't talk about what has happened in courtrooms. You can't talk about what's in the Epstein files. You can't make jokes about Donald Trump. Oh, and here's the King of England treat you like a hallowed figure, to treat you like a respected figure. Why is he there? And what is it either hoping or likely to achieve? 0345 6060 973. Keith, I hope you've noticed I'm hitting all my junctions on time today. It won't last, but here's Lottie Morley with your headlines.
Kemi Badenoch has told LBC there's no doubt in her mind that the Prime Minister misled MPs about the hiring of Lord Mandelson. The Conservative leader says Sir Keir Starmer is forcing MPs to back him on the issue in a vote later. Sir Keir denies misleading the Commons. The King and Queen are due to begin the first full day of their state visit to the US after being welcomed with tea at the White House. They were greeted by Donald Trump and the First Lady after landing in Washington last night. And the Education Secretary has told LBC the government will not U-turn on plans for social media for under-16s. Bridget Phillotson has said there could still be a full ban on the way, depending on the outcome of a consultation. LBC weather turning brighter across England and Wales with some sunshine this afternoon, feeling cooler with a high of 20 degrees.
This is LBC.
Get that Euro Millions feeling this Friday. 10 UK winners are guaranteed to be millionaires. That's 10 more reasons to dance. 10 more robots, 10 more limbos, 10 more salsas. 10 UK winners are guaranteed to be millionaires this Friday.
Euro Millions from the National Lottery. It could be you. Rules apply, 18 plus.
Noticed a change in your hearing? Well, get a hearing check from Specsavers. Oh, not sure where to start? Well, we're very flexible. Book one online, on the phone, on your lunch break, on Saturdays, on the same day if you're lucky. Oh, you only miss the odd word. But what if the odd words you're missing are nice ones like love you, or important ones like duck? Oh, too expensive, is it? All right, we like you. We'll do it for nothing. For free hearing checks, should have gone to Specsavers.
My name's Dame Leslie Regan, consultant gynaecologist and chair of the charity Wellbeing of Women. At Wellbeck London, we don't just treat our patients, we design an entire experience. Across every specialty, we select only those colleagues we would send our own families to. The result? A community of exceptional doctors constantly learning from each other, so you will always see the best doctor for you.
Discover more at Wellbeck.com. Wellbeck London. Beyond better healthcare.
One of the best things about a holiday with Saga is your chauffeur who'll pick you up and drive you to your departure point. Whether you're river cruising along the Rhine or uncovering centuries of history on a tour of Japan. Even better, they'll pick you up and drive you home again afterwards. 2027 season now on sale. Search Saga Holidays. Experience is everything. Nationwide chauffeur service available on UK mainland. Full terms apply. Over 50s only. At all protected.
I'm Will Buxton.
I'm Naomi Schiff.
I'm David Coulthard.
And I'm Joni Shaw.
This is Up to Speed. Available every Monday and Thursday on Global Player or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
It is, I mean, extraordinary, isn't it? The speed with which everything falls apart, as W.B. Yeats observed. The blatant lie that he's been completely exonerated over Epstein, that he said in that ill-tempered exchange on CBS News a couple of days ago. It's just a blatant lie. And glossing over the fact that E. Jean Carroll, her name is, the woman that he sued for libel after she accused him of rape, he lost that case. Which leads to some fairly clear and obvious conclusions. And yet he sits there on live television in front of America and, by association, the rest of the world, and simply states things that are known not to be true. He has not been exonerated over his inclusion in the Epstein files. And yet here we are, sending the king to visit, who, of course, has his own embarrassments associated with the Epstein files on the part of his brother Andrew Windsor. So what? What is the point of this trip? What is the point of this trip, given that any arguments, unless you can make them more powerfully than I can, about the necessity of restoring warm relations, are rendered relatively ridiculous by the fact that Donald Trump will tell you that you're the best thing since sliced bread at 10 past 12 on a Tuesday, and by half past he's calling you scum. And of course, he does use language like that all the time. As they call for the sacking of the comedian and late-night TV host Jimmy Kimmel, they themselves talk constantly in the most violent of ways. Most recently, probably, if you leave the insults levelled at British war dead to one side, something that King Charles is probably going to be required not to bring up today. That's awful. Absolutely awful. But you would probably think to the recent death of the former FBI chief Robert Mueller, who as a member of the United States Marine Corps in Vietnam, received both a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star for heroism in the service of his country in a war that Donald Trump faked a medical condition to avoid. It is often alleged. I don't even know what bone spurs are. But the idea that he says, "I'm glad he's dead," and now we're supposed to clutch our pearls and call for the cancellation of a comedian who made a joke about his wife becoming a widow relatively soon because he's so much older than her? These are the moments where you have to hang on to your hat. You have to keep talking about it. And you heard in that clip that I played you how much nastiness and unpleasantness he'll put into trying to stop people saying things he doesn't want to hear. So a gunman, apparently, as he seems to believe, considered Donald Trump to be a rapist and a paedophile, and therefore decided to undertake an attack upon a hotel in Washington. That's what Donald Trump has chosen to believe as a consequence of reading that manifesto, but he doesn't want anybody else to read it or refer to what's in it. It's mad, right? So why is the king there? Martin is in Aldershot. Martin, what would you like to say?
James, I think we're looking too much into it, to be honest. He's been sent over there to kiss butt.
Suck up. Is that a deliberately American turn of phrase that you've sought to employ there, Martin?
No, that's me trying not to swear.
Yes, fair enough. Yes, no, I get that. And respectfully, you're not thinking into it enough. I should counter your accusation that I'm thinking in it. Because what will that involve and what is it likely to achieve? This is a man who you could shower with, you know, gold coins, or you could give him a FIFA Peace Prize on a Monday, and on a Tuesday he'll turn around and spit in your face. So what's the point of trying to kiss his, excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, kiss his butt?
Yeah, it's a pretty gross thought, but
what's the point?
It's to play to his ego, to make him feel more important. And, you know, he's, like you just said, he's going to throw it back in either the king's face or the country's face within the next 24 hours anyway. It's there for Starmer sent him over to basically try and build the relationship between the two countries or make it a little better than it already is. But it's not going to work. It's just going to... Yeah. It's going to make...
This is Occam's razor, isn't it? This is the only thing that's really going to fit the space available, is that they think that it will restore relations or bring back some warmth to relations that has disappeared, particularly since Keir Starmer refused to get involved in that illegal war. It's the diplomatic equivalent, then, of what journalists do. It's because I've said a million times in the last 18 months, we don't know what to do as a profession. You have to report him like you would any other president, even as he does and says things that no other president would contemplate doing, and if they did, they would have been impeached. He's sort of broken everything in that way. Yeah. And we don't know what to do. Journalists still have to report his every utterance as if it was reliable or true or based in fact and evidence, even as we know that it isn't. The diplomatic corps, the royal family, the foreign office, they have to seek to restore relations with a fractious White House, regardless of the fact that the bloke in it is utterly unreliable.
Trump reminds me of the man in the pub that everyone kind of pretends to like, and he thinks that he's friends with everyone, you know?
And
you kind of put up with him whilst you have to, say hello and be nice, again, play to his ego.
Laugh at his jokes.
And then as soon as you're out the room, you're like, oh, thank God he's gone, or, you know. It's one of them. And for the relationship for the country, I mean, how long's Trump got left in power? A couple of years at most, unless he manages to change the constitution. I think the relationship will go back to how it was once him and his.
I'm not so sure, actually, and certainly not militarily. I kind of lean towards former NATO chief George Robertson, who's talked quite a lot of rubbish recently, but on this one thing, I think he was right, that dependency that we have, and I think this probably holds true across all of Europe, that's going to go forever now, because you know what can happen. So you can't be dependent upon someone who has revealed, and by someone I mean a country, who has revealed that they are perfectly prepared to cut that umbilical for no particular reason. You could get another drooling Genghis, which is a rather wonderful phrase deployed by Emma, who has texted me while you were talking, Martin. He's a drooling Genghis. They're trying to use the old playbook of dazzling the dictator, but Trump is a demented warlord, a drooling Genghis. You get another drooling Genghis in the White House, and if we're still militarily reliant upon the United States of America, we will only have ourselves to blame, because once is careless, but twice is I've forgotten the figure of speech. What is it? Once, twice is terrible. Tom's in Hemel Hempstead. Tom, what would you like to say?
Good morning.
Hello.
So I know we're focusing a lot this morning on Trump the man, and there's no doubt he's disreputable. However, I strongly believe that Charles has gone to America with a far, far longer view of the world and our place in the world,
yes,
and our relationship with America. So we're probably not going to get any short-term benefit from Charles having gone to America. But in the longer term, Charles is there to remind the American people that actually our nations are bonded, certainly militarily by blood, over the last 100 years.
Do you think they feel that? Do you think they still feel that? They feel it a bit, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Yes.
I believe so.
Yes.
And actually, I think Charles of the Royal, who they have an incredible fondness for, the royal family, is there to demonstrate dignity under fire. He's there to demonstrate statesmanship. He's there to demonstrate that actually the sort of British way of doing things quietly and just getting on with the job at hand is actually still going to be the most important thing when Trump leaves office, because the man won't be there for more than another 3 years, we hope. And actually, once we get to that point, there'll be somebody else sitting in the Oval Office, and we still need to be able to...
We will have accrued goodwill. If you were selling, I would buy what you are selling. Because I would like this to be true, but it is a decision taken by Keir Starmer, not by the King, not by the palace. That is a matter of fact, not a matter of opinion, and I can't quite see Keir Starmer potentially demeaning the King in pursuit of a goodwill that will only kick in when quite possibly neither of them are in the post anymore. You know, it could be that we have a different prime minister and a different monarch when the dividend that you describe is received. That's what makes me think you're being a little bit rose-tinted.
No, that's a fair point to make. However, I counter that by saying...
Hang on a minute, this is far too polite. What are we doing, making fair points and countering each other in a respectful fashion? It'll never catch on. Carry on, Tom. You monster.
I'm being nervously respectful. when Trump is gone, and no question, Starmer will be gone possibly in the relatively near future.
Yes.
Actually, the person that remains, or the body that remains, if you like, is the royal family. And by going there, and by extending the hand of friendship, not to Trump, Charles has to do that,
yes,
but to American people, it just reminds them that we're still here, we're still friends, and actually individuals, Starmer, Trump, Vance, all the other people running around the Oval Office, they will not and cannot break that bond. Plus also, James, if you look at it absolutely realistically, and on the global stage, we can't turn east. There's nothing there for us. We have to keep our eyes to the West. And the long-term relationship is so much more important than the short-term relationship.
We can turn to the Near East.
Well, yes, but not the Far East.
No, I just wanted to clarify that you weren't maligning France.
Oh, no, not at all. Sorry, I'm in the Far East. I beg your pardon. You're absolutely right.
I thought you did.
I'm laughing on the subject, and I've got other things to say about that.
I'm tempted to have that conversation sooner rather than later, Tom, so I look forward to your contribution, because a few people pointing out this morning that the United States can't go back to what it was before, which kind of means our relationship with the United States can't go back to what it was before. So what will our relationship be in a world where NATO has been denuded and quite possibly a European army is building, and we face a decision as a country whether or not we want to sort of move our chips away from NATO and towards the near, but most definitely not the far, east. It is 10:44. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Emma is in Liverpool. Emma, what would you like to say?
Hi there.
Hello.
I was disconcerted there because Tom, the last guy, sounded a bit like Nigel Farage.
No, he did. You can't say that about people on this programme. He'll sue you.
He did not sound
anything like Nigel Farage. For a start, I don't think
he lied. We can have an argument already.
He didn't lie once.
I wanted to say that the King, he's kind of really emotionally intelligent. I think he's fully aware of the tenuous sort of world situation because it's basically in the hands of a dangerous narcissist.
Yes.
And
a drooling Genghis.
Well, whatever. They tend to get really offended very easily, but they also kind of say and do whatever they like. And they file things under all good and all bad. So Starmer has been filed under all bad, hasn't he? So
by Trump, he has. Yeah, I think his personal situation is probably irredeemable. But he should wear that as a badge of honour. He shouldn't be trying to reverse it.
No, but of course not. But the King is thinking, well, look, this could go really wrong if he gets any more of the hump with Starmer. So I'm going to go out and smooth it all over. And he knows that as a narcissist, the biggest thrill for Trump is to get the royal stamp of approval.
He's my good friend. I'm not doing impressions. I'm rubbish at impressions. He's my good friend. That is when I don't think I've ever felt sorrier for a monarch than I did when Donald Trump announced that King Charles was his good friend. You can almost, you know, when he does that face, he does that sort of wince, doesn't he? He looks
exactly
a bit like Wallace or Gromit. He does that thing with his mouth. He's like, oh, God, Corinna, can you believe it?
He literally got so much supply from this visit. And you can see in the pictures, he's kind of elevated on his already elevated shoes about 50 inches.
Yeah, and then doing the ludicrous handshake
Yeah, I think the King's done exactly the right thing, and I think it will really put the UK in a safer place, because at the moment,
sweet summer child, Emma.
Really?
I hope you're right, but I think you might be a little optimistic. Does the fact that they have decided not to do anything in front of the cameras, the King and the Queen, King Charles will be spared the potential humiliation of being upbraided in public by Donald Trump. They have decided he can't be trusted in front of the camera. Mm. Does that change your view? Does that make your position stronger or weaker?
What he's dealing with, so that there's pictures of them already. If you look at the time,
yeah, and they'll be halfway around the world. Pictures are fine, but we don't need to listen
to because he knows that he'll get stitched up by, you know, looking like he's a mate of his. But he's just going there to try and steer the UK's position into out of the enemy box into the sort of ally box again.
Yeah, I owe you an apology.
Do you?
Yeah.
Why?
Because loads of people think that Tom sounded like Farage.
Oh, really good.
Yeah,
Tom. He made loads of good points, and the guy before him did as well.
That's something else you'd never get from the original Farage. But the M's been so. I just ended a phone call. I tuned back in, and I thought you were talking to Nigel Farage. He's always welcome on the programme.
I'm so glad about that.
Well, you know, you were right. Jim says he did sound like him. Ismail says he did sound like Nigel Garrard.
He did.
I didn't pick up on that myself. I shall listen more closely next time Tom rings in. If he ever does now, you've probably offended him mortally, and he'll go and off and listen to North Norfolk Digital or something like that. Thank you, Emma. Aggie Chambray will be with us shortly to have a little look at what has been going on at the Foreign Affairs Select Committee today and the question of... It's slightly desperate dance around the studios this morning by Kemi Badenoch, when no one is really suggesting that Keir Starmer has consciously misled the House. So I suspect we're looking at a semantic pinhead on whether or not pressure means pressure. Or whether the pressure that he said hadn't been applied had been applied, or different pressures were applied, but they would always be applied, so he didn't say anything out of the ordinary. But Aggie will bring us up to date, up to speed, up to sniff after this.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
Across the political spectrum, in every age group, this poll suggests that you want to cut benefits to see the economy grow. If you did a benefit street on pensioners, you'd similarly think, actually, there's a huge amount of money that is being spent on people just because they are older. There are older people who need that money, but there are some older people who don't.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no, just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
McDonald's breakfast is turning up the heat with a spicy new twist. Calm down, not that spicy. Breakfast is for savoring, not suffering. Introducing McDonald's breakfast with Frank's Red Hot Ketchup. A spicy breakfast suitable for the morning. Until 8th of June, served until 11 a.m, subject to availability.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. Or wobbly, or wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxed.
George is up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby. Download the Thames Link Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thames Link Railway, where every stop is a story.
Hi, I'm Sava, founder of Cool U, the daddy of air conditioning. For over 15 years, Cool U have specialised in installing our fully internal aircon systems with no mess, no fuss, and no external condenser. Perfect for modern apartments, conservation areas, listed properties, or simply for those who don't want an ugly unit on the outside. Head to coolu.london. Cool U, for a cool, comfortable home.
Shine Night Walk London is a 10K, half marathon or full marathon supported walk around the city at night on the 19th of September to raise vital money for Cancer Research UK. It's also
everyone walking with all their colours, twinkling away.
We can actually see how nice London is. And London is different at night time.
Celebration of life, and it gives hope.
Step towards a brighter future at shinewalk.org today to get 30% off your entry. Together, we are beating cancer. T's and C's apply.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? A record 9 years running.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
Everybody needs a hero, and my hero this week, until something probably emerges about him, is a senior talent agent in the United States of America called Michael Glantz, who has an heir of another senior talent agent who is better known on this side of the Atlantic, called Michael Whitehall, father of Jack, husband of Hillary, and Stone Cold legend. He's my guest on Full Disclosure this week. And I mention that solely because he is literally on the latest episode of Full Disclosure, and he was a senior talent agent. But Michael Glantz, who works for Creative Artists Agency, is the chap that you may have seen finishing his dinner, eating salad, as the Secret Service in the hotel, the Hilton Hotel in Washington, where that attack took place on Saturday night. He just utterly unmoved by the whole thing. He stayed there eating his burrata salad. That's a fancy cheese, Keith. Eating his burrata salad as everyone else was sort of being evacuated from the building if they were important, or running away themselves if they were not considered to be important enough. I'm a New Yorker, he told the New York Times in a brief interview after Donald Trump was bundled to safety amid a scene of chaos. We live with sirens and activity happening all the time. I wasn't scared. There are hundreds of Secret Service agents hurtling themselves over tables and chairs, and I wanted to watch. And he said, this is why I love the man, and this is what reminded me of Michael Whitehall. He said, first of all, I have a bad back. I couldn't get on the floor, and if I did get on the floor, they'd have to bring in people to get me off the floor. Which reminds me of a letter to the Times the other day in response to an elderly reader revealing details of him and his wife's sex life. And the Times reader replied, he wrote in and said, I was delighted to read about John Bloggs's sex life. And my wife was inspired. She said, I want you to take me upstairs. I want you to go upstairs and make love to me. To which I replied, well, I can't do both, darling. Such is the plight of a bad back. There's an introduction for you, Aggie Chambray. What's been going on at the Foreign Affairs Select Committee?
Well, James, we have had Sir Philip Barton, who, of course, is the former civil service boss at the Foreign Office, and he's been answering questions before Morgan McSweeney will take over that role of answering questions in just 6 or so minutes' time. There are two key questions today because of this vote later. And those two key questions are, number one, was there pressure from number 10 to get the appointment of Lord Mandelson approved? This is what Sir Philip Barton replied to that.
During my tenure, I was not aware of any pressure on the substance of the Mandelson DV case. Question two, was there pressure? Absolutely. And I've described it, and I also have seen what the Foreign Office said to you last night, and recognise what is said in that letter about the pressure to get it done, i.e. DV clearance, by a particular timescale.
So effectively saying there was pressure on the timescale, but there was not pressure on the substance of whether or not Lord Mandelson would be approved on developed betting.
It's almost as if I knew what I was talking about when I said we were heading for a dance on a semantic pinhead. So, I mean, it depends, doesn't it? It's in the ear of the beholder. If I said to you, I'd like you on the show at 10:55 today, could you come down at 10:54? You would be under pressure to come down at 10:54 and appear on the programme. If I said to you, I want you to announce live on air that Kemi Badenoch is a burst balloon, and you would say, I can't possibly do that, I'm far too professional. And I said, I'm terribly sorry, but if you don't do that, then it's curtains for you, Aggie Chambray. That would be a very different sort of pressure that would be unacceptable and unexpected. But saying to someone, here's what we want, get your skates on, is what we have.
I think that is the argument he's making. I suppose maybe it's sort of you saying to me a few different times, are you going to be down here?
Come on, hurry up. Don't forget, 10:54, come on, Aggie.
I think that is
pressure. It's still pressure.
Pressure, absolutely. And you know, Keir Starmer said over the weekend there are different types of pressure. And actually,
say that in the Sunday Times. He said this account here from Barton actually supports what Starmer said at the weekend.
I think that's probably right. And I think it's worth saying at this stage, James, because there was this report actually from the Foreign Affairs Select Committee that Morgan McSweeney, the former Chief of Staff, who we are going to hear from shortly, had phoned up Sir Philip Barton and said flipping approve him. He didn't say flipping. Well, apparently he actually didn't say anything at all. So he'd already denied that, but Sir Philip Barton was asked about that today and basically said that he'd heard different versions of the story. Yeah. He's really racked his brains, but he can't recall Morgan McSweeney ever swearing
in
a meeting
at
him. I don't know. It's a curious tale because it was actually never really reported, but the Foreign Affairs Select Committee said it had been reported. It actually hadn't been reported, and now it seems to have been denied by all parties. Slightly bizarre, yes. Also, Sir Philip Barton was asked whether there was would happen, whether there was a possibility that Lord Mandelson would have failed vetting after he had been announced.
I mean, it would have been a crisis if we got to the point where he had no vetting clearance. That would have been a crisis. So evidently a publicly announced political appointment as the next ambassador to Washington, not being able to go, that would have been a big problem.
So that really about whether or not, because of course Lord Mandelson was announced in the December and the developed vetting had not been done at that stage, and him being asked, you know, would it have been possible for them to actually at that stage, which Sir Keir Starmer has said he would have done had he known what the outcome of the vetting, then he would have pulled Lord Mandelson from being ambassador. But Sir Philip Barton saying there that would have been a crisis. James, we dealt with one of the two things that the Tories are pushing for this vote later today on the Privileges Committee. Number one, of course, was there pressure? Keir Starmer saying no undue pressure. And number two was was due process followed? And listen, so Sir Philip Barton was asked that question, and listen as well to the pause at the beginning of his response.
I'm going to dodge. I'm really sorry, but I just actually don't think it's for me to sit here in. Yeah, it's not for me to, it's for others, you know, including, you know, all of you as members of Parliament to come to a view on that.
So I think that was quite an interesting response from him, basically refusing to say whether or not.
Can we hear that again? Let's just hear that again with the silence as well. Well, just
I'm going to dodge. I'm really sorry, but I just actually don't think it's for me to sit here in... Yeah, it's not for me to... It's for others, you know, including, you know, all of you as members of Parliament to come to a view on that.
And so that is, again, the idea of pressure is a mutable term. It's not a binary issue. You can't say, yes, there was, no, there wasn't. You have to... That he's saying, I can't decide whether or not this is what his critics say it was.
Mm. Well, that's about due process. And I think that will be really interesting for Labour MPs who are making that decision later on how to vote in the Privileges Committee inquiry. Because
that's the worst bit of the exchange for Starmer's point of view, I think.
I think so, because he won't just say, yes.
Yeah, nothing to see here.
Yes, it was correct.
Ollie Robbins did. Essentially.
Exactly.
Right, okay.
So that, I think, is worth noting. And finally, from Sir Philip Barton, there was this big news line, or big news nugget, I should say, out of Sir Ollie Robbins, where he said that Number 10 had talked about the possibility and asked him about potentially giving Lord Doyle, Matthew Doyle, who was former head of comms in Downing Street, a job in the diplomatic service, but not to tell David Lammy. And Sir Philip Barton was... basically said that sometimes permanent secretaries are told to keep things from their Secretary of State.
It's not unheard of for a permanent secretary to be privy to something that they don't pass on to, or ask not to, rather, pass on to their Secretary of State. So I would describe it as not unheard of, but I don't want to give the impression that this is kind of standard operating procedure.
This is extraordinary. It's absolutely extraordinary. So the Foreign Secretary, so the permanent secretary at the Foreign Office can be told... don't tell your boss about this when they are the Foreign Secretary. Is that, I mean, does it honestly, have you, honestly, has that ever happened to you before this?
Yes, it has.
Really?
Yeah.
You learn something new every day.
She went full Lady Bracknell there, didn't she, Emily Thornberry? That's extraordinary. A handbag. Just a quick word on the importance of the civil service, because, of course, very bad actors in the political world like to use words like blob and deep state. And despite the fact that they're all quite mad, some of these discourse, some of this vocabulary takes a hold. These are the guys who kind of keep an eye on everything, aren't they? And so his response, surprisingly... sanguine, yes. I mean, it's all very well, you, Madam Chair, having a fit of the vapours over this, but it does happen. It happens all the time. Carry on. That's it, really.
I think that's it. And I think lots of people looking forward to Morgan McSweeney, who will be speaking in the next few minutes, as someone that really hasn't been heard from, well, really ever, and was, of course, Sir Keir Starmer's right-hand man for so long, former Chief of Staff, up until a few months ago. And who knows whether Keir Starmer would be where he is at the moment without this man.
Absolute hate figure for the left of the left. So he will be asked, presumably, what talks did he have about vetting, and did he press the Foreign Office to speed up? I mean, it's extraordinary, to paraphrase Dame Emily Thornberry, that just effing approve the appointment has entered into the sort of national mythology, despite the fact, as you've pointed out, absolutely nobody involved at either end of the alleged phone conversation has said that it happened. In fact, they've all denied that it happened or insisted they have no memory of it happening at all. I'm going a bit Emily Thornberry here. I find that extraordinary. Has this ever happened before?
Well, it's honestly so odd, because the Foreign Affairs Select Committee said to Ollie Robbins that Sky News had reported it. But then they said...
Name Sam Coates?
They named Sam Coates, said Sam Coates from Sky News reported this. And then a couple of days later, when Kat Little was in front of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, they said, oh, by the way, Sam Coates never actually reported that. Anyway, moving on.
Has anyone checked with Sam Coates?
Yes, he didn't report it.
Well, I'd say, what the hell is going on? Curious here and curious, has said Alice. And speaking of Lady Bracknell, that quote I was searching for and failing to find earlier was also from The Importance of Being Earnest, and of course I got it the wrong way round. Ah, dear. Once is unfortunate, twice is careless. Unfortunately, me being me, I can't remember what I was using that quote to illustrate about 40 minutes ago, but if you can remember, well, there you go. And if you can't remember, you can listen back live on the Global Player.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Kemi Badenoch has told LBC the government is scared of a parliamentary inquiry into the Peter Mandelson vetting row. Sir Keir Starmer has asked his backbenchers to stand together in a vote on whether he should be investigated. The Conservatives say the Prime Minister misled Parliament over Mandelson's appointment as US ambassador. Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson has told us it's a cynical move from the Tories.
A matter of days from important elections across the country. And the Tories are seeking to make this an issue. Of course they are, because they don't want us to be talking about the change that we're bringing to working people across the country, whether it's, you know, the big changes we're making on apprenticeships, on expanding free school meals, on more rights for renters.
The Conservative leader has also told LBC that it's not for Donald Trump to criticise Sir Keir Starmer because he's our idiot. Kemi Badenoch says it's her job to hold the Prime Minister to account, not the US President's.
When allies have public spats, the only people who benefit are our opponents. I remember as Trade Secretary, other countries doing things that were actually harmful to the UK. And my conversations were behind closed doors. They were on the phone. It was never coming out to have spats. I think Donald Trump is wrong to do that. You know, Keir Starmer is, he's our idiot, basically. We don't want the US criticising, him. That's my job.
The King and Queen have arrived in Washington, D.C. for the start of a four-day state visit. King Charles will address Congress later, where he's expected to describe the UK-US relationship as one of the greatest alliances in human history. The Education Secretary has told LBC there's no U-turn on the way when it comes to social media restrictions for under-16s. Bridget Phillipson has said there could still be a full ban on the way, depending on the outcome of a consultation. And a superyacht linked to a sanctioned Russian billionaire has managed to sail through the Strait of Hormuz. Shipping data shows the yacht, worth more than $500 million, is one of the very few vessels to travel along the blocked shipping route recently. It's not clear how it gained permission to use the strait after leaving Dubai on Friday and arriving in Muscat on Sunday. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 47 points at 10,369. The pound buys $1.35 and a euro 15. LBC weather turning brighter across England and Wales with some sunshine this afternoon, feeling cooler with a high of 20 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible, and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Six minutes after 11 is the time. I suspect Aki Shambrake will be back in the studio before the hour is out, because Morgan McSweeney is now giving evidence to the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, the Prime Minister's ex-chief of staff, widely regarded as the Machiavelli, I don't know, that might be a bit pejorative, or the brains, if you prefer, behind Keir Starmer's successful bid for the leadership of the Labour Party and subsequent purge of the people that had caused such problems during Jeremy Corbyn's tenure. That's an observation of fact. You can have a personal view on whether it was for good or for ill. But I've never heard his voice. Which is extraordinary, isn't it, really, for somebody who's been at the heart of political conversations for the longest time. So we will dip in very briefly and hear it.
Through public institutions, MPs, ministers, civil servants, diplomats, security professionals and many others whose work is demanding, often unseen. In the Cabinet Office, the Foreign Office and 10 Downing Street, there will be many people working long hours now to understand what happened here and to ensure lessons are learned. They deserve fairness and respect as they do that work. Chair, I'm here to assist the committee in its work. I made a serious mistake in recommending Mandelson's appointment. I accept the consequences and hope today I can help the committee to establish the facts and to make sure the right lessons are learned.
Thank you. Now, why was it necessary to
replace... And as I say, Aki Shambrake, keep an ear and an eye on that for you. I'm probably going to embarrass myself now in my Irish listeners. Limerick, is he? Is he Limerick? It's not Cork. It's Scottish. But anyway, 8 minutes. A lot of people probably didn't realise he was Irish. In the first, well, I hope he's Irish, otherwise my accent radar. Is he Cork? Is he Cork? Not Limerick. Oh, okay. 8 minutes after 11 is the time. Something completely different now. A conversation I don't think we've ever had before. And it is a suggestion from the Chancellor of the Exchequer that all private sector homes that are rented have a one-year rent freeze imposed from above. So landlords in England would be banned from raising rents for a limited period of time under the proposals. This is part of the looming cost of living package that the government is due to launch in the coming weeks as a direct consequence in many ways of the privations caused by Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu's ludicrous exertions, murderous exertions in the Middle East, in Iran particularly. I despair at the way that fuel prices have been discussed, not just by members of the media who lost something precious in 2016 and have never really got it back, but also by politicians of all complexions. About petrol prices and conducting conversations without any mention of the Strait of Hormuz, as if it's Keir Starmer's fault that the price of petrol is going up. Or that there's an awful lot that can be done about it without taking money away from other parts of public spending. It's a simplism. It's a pathetic simplism. I've ignited a massive conversation now about Irish accents. It would appear that nobody thought he sounded like he came from Limerick, so I won't be doing that again. But the idea of a rent freeze speaks directly to two things. It speaks directly to, and this is really interesting, it speaks directly to the cost of living crisis, or the cost of living problems, let us say, that are being exacerbated by the war in Iran, but it also speaks directly to things chancellors of the Exchequer can do that are not immediately obvious. So, you know, it would be a rise in VAT or an increase in capital gains tax or the removal of mortgage relief. You know, the kind of thing that essentially depends upon the tap of money making its way from the public to the Treasury, and then the tap of money or the hose pipe of money making its way from the Treasury to the public. That is government. That is the essential part of government. You collect the taxes and then you spend them. If you didn't collect the taxes, there would be no society to speak of. You'd only ever be interested in laying down tarmac that you drove on. So you wouldn't be able to. You know how the world works. But this is different because this doesn't actually involve taxation in the first instance. It doesn't involve clear taxation. And it posits a really interesting notion. It posits the notion that if you are a landlord, you need to take a hit to help your tenant. It takes away your choice. I always think it's important, and nothing of all the things I do that cause a curious reaction from you sometimes, saying that not all landlords are bad has always struck me as one of the least controversial things to say. Some people can't buy a house, and some people don't want to buy a house. Some people don't want to own their own homes, and if it wasn't for landlords, they wouldn't have anywhere to live. And some landlords are great. Some landlords do not ramp the cost of their rent up to the highest possible pip-squeaking total. And they do fix your washing machine when it's broken, and they'd be mortified if there was black mould in the back bedroom. And, of course, some other landlords are the opposite of that. To speak about landlords as a homogenous cohort of human beings is not necessarily helpful. But it is a commercial exercise. Being a landlord is almost always a decision taken in the hope of financial reward. There are a few of us who have been landlords over the years, almost by accident, because you were moving house and you hadn't sold the one before and you didn't want to lose the next one you were going to, so you were able to get a bridging loan, and then you still didn't sell the old house, so you had to bring tenants in order to service the interest on the... I digress. The point is this, landlords are in a powerful financial position even if they think they're not. Compared to their tenants, they are financially healthier. That is a truism. There will be exceptions, but they are exceptions to the rule. that they will be financially healthier than their tenants, unless they are appalling at being landlords. Okay? If the population is facing squeezes as a consequence of the impact of the Iran war, then people renting will be, again, I generalise, but people renting their properties will be more vulnerable to increases in the cost of living than other people because they are, by definition, less financially healthy than people who own properties or people who have mortgages. If you've got a mortgage, you were able to accrue a deposit. These are generalizations, but they are truisms. Most people renting will be more financially fragile than people paying mortgages. You might not like that, but that's why I use the word most, not the word all. So, as the landlords face the pinch, as the landlords feel the consequence of the Iran war on their budgets, and they find themselves thinking, I need a bit more cash to sustain the status quo of my life. We go all Mr. Micawber on this. I need to bring in a little bit more money in order to meet the increase in my outgoings. How does a landlord do that? By putting rent up on the property or properties, plural, that they own. So a landlord is asking a tenant, the healthier partner in this financial relationship, is demanding from the less healthy partner that the less healthy partner helps the healthy partner meet the increased demands upon their income. So there are two things going on here. Either the renter helps the landlord through the financial crisis and suffers themselves as a consequence, or the landlord is compelled to help the renter through the financial crisis and they suffer the consequences. I like this policy. For what it's worth, if you are a landlord, I don't think they will do it. I suspect, if it hasn't happened already, then the massed ranks of our right-wing media will be deploying vast reserves of tiny violins and insisting that people who are in a position to ask tenants to buy houses for them are actually the real... It'll be like the VAT on school fees all over again. I don't believe in poverty. There's no such thing as poverty in 21st century Britain. But my God, those poor people who are going to have to pay VAT on their children's school fees, we really won't somebody think of them. You're going to get that. And you get it in the Telegraph, you get it in the Mail. It will influence discourse elsewhere. People who sort of snort up ludicrous coverage in those newspapers and then spew it out on broadcast platforms, they'll be doing it as well, because there is nothing that the right-wing media exists for if not to protect wealth. And although you will deny that you are wealthy, if you are a certain type of landlord, you are wealthier than your tenant. How do I know that? Because you've got an asset and they haven't. But the right-wing media exists to protect wealth and often to do little else. To do little else. Just protect wealth. Make sure the plebs don't come for us. Let's get them angry about immigrants or welfare claimants or single mothers or whatever it is this week. The two-minute hate is directed at, as long as it's not wealth. As long as it's not the owning class. And yes, some landlords will not be comfortably off even. And there may be difficulties. Financial circumstances may have changed. You might still have a rental property, but you got made redundant last year or you lost your job last month. And so the idea that you are home and dry or over the line or doing really, really well, is a little bit naive. But tell me why I shouldn't like this measure. Rent control has been called for years by various people. I think Sadiq Khan has even had a crack at that particular principle. But the idea of a freeze, a one-year freeze on private sector homes, will Tufton Street will go bonkers. Of course they will, because they exist exclusively, as I said, to protect wealth. Oh, here you go. Here's someone from the Centre for Policy Studies saying, this feels like a mind-boggling scale of intervention in the private market. If the government wants to bring rents down, it should build an awful lot more houses. Yeah, what? Within the next 6 months? And these people are nothing if not predictable. Hello, is that Tufton Street? Yeah, it doesn't matter which outfit you're from. You're all the same, really. Could we just get a quote from you on why this attempt to redistribute a little bit of wealth from the owning class to the rentier class is absolutely disgusting and outrageous? Oh, yes, certainly, says Robert Colville, the head of the Centre for Policy Studies. Is this okay? Will this do? This feels like a mind-boggling scale of intervention in the private market. If the government wants to bring rents down, it should build an awful lot more houses. Yeah, that's great, thanks. And that's in The Guardian, so God knows what they'll get quoted in The Telegraph or The Daily Mail. So tell me why I shouldn't like it. A 12-month freeze on private sector rents until the heaviest impacts of the war in Iran have passed. Why a rent freeze is a good idea? 0345 6060 973, or a bad idea? It's 18 minutes after 11. And I'll take personal testimony as well. As a landlord, tell me why this will crush you, this will destroy you. Because that is evidence for the defence. That is a reason why I shouldn't be in favour of it. There'd have to be quite a lot of you, I suppose. But what do you think? What do we think of a British Chancellor in 2026 doing something that I don't remember ever having been done before in this country and introducing a 12-month freeze on private sector, not public sector rents? Here are the numbers now. You will get through. 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC.
Noticed a change in your hearing? Well, get a hearing check from Specsavers. Oh, not sure where to start? Well, we're very flexible. Book one online, on the phone, on your lunch break, on Saturdays, on the same day if you're lucky. Oh, you only miss the odd word. But what if the odd words you're missing are nice ones like love you, or important ones like duck? Oh, too expensive, is it? All right, we like you. We'll do it for nothing. For free hearing checks, should have gone to Specsavers.
Take Irish Ferries from Dover to Calais, where your pet travels in the pet lounge. You'd be barking not to. Irish Ferries. See travel differently.
Ready for a new kitchen? Find the one at Wix. With kitchens for first homes and forever homes too. Visit Wix today.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. That's why right now you can get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it. And the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Will Buxton.
I'm Naomi Schiff.
I'm David Coulthard.
And I'm Jolie Shaw.
This is Up to Speed. Available every Monday and Thursday on Global Player or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 6060 973.
It is 21 minutes after 11. Of course, if you were to phone up Tufton Street for a response to an announcement that the government is going to increase taxes in order to build more houses, they would respond with similar outrage to how they respond to the suggestion from the government that private sector rents be frozen. What do we think? Because, look, I want to be absolutely clear. It might be a daft idea. I don't think there's any guarantee that just because it's new doesn't it means it's brilliant. It might be a really stupid idea, and not just from the perspective of greedy or non-greedy landlords who resent the idea of not being able to ramp their rents up for 12 months. It might be a stupid idea. It might be a very silly idea, but I need you to tell me why. I need you to explain the deets to me. 11:21. Richard is in Brentford. Hey, God's own country. Richard, what would you like to say?
Hello.
Hello.
I think I saw you in your favourite pub, but let's not go there.
Well, you can if you want. Which one? The Black Dog? Or the? There you go. Yes, you did.
Yeah.
Say hello anyway. Next time. Buy me a pint.
I didn't want to disturb you.
That's very,
anyway,
very kind. Carry on.
I'm a landlord. I've got one property, which I rent out. I'm subject to interest-only mortgage.
Okay.
And my monthly costs right now are something like £1,400 a month, plus any unforeseen, repairs or
yes,
bills or whatever. So £1,400. Those are my costs. My rent is £1,200. So why are you, not you, but why...
You can use me if you want. I think I'm going to have to buy you a pint now.
you are. Why would you want me to subsidise people. I don't get that kind of protection from the building society. I can't say, oh, I want a mortgage.
But you're losing £200 a month on your investment.
Yeah, and I actually reduced my rent a couple of years ago.
The hope would be that the equity goes up, even if you're losing money on a monthly basis, which is not guaranteed at the moment in the way that it has been for the last 25 years or so. I don't want to fall out with you, and so I put this very much in interrogative tone. It's very much a question. But doesn't this just mean you are one of the very small band of people I referenced a moment ago as just being not very good at this landlording lark?
How can you say that?
I said I wasn't saying it. I was asking it.
I'm going to punch you in the eye.
You can't punch me in the eye. It's a genuine inquiry, because most landlords would expect to turn a profit of sorts upon their rental investments.
You want people to work to make their way in this world, don't you?
Your tenants work to help you make your way in this world.
Yeah. But I'm one of those. I'm one of those who I actually have 5 properties at one point, and I've sold them all over the years. But what I'm asking you is, why should I be in a worse position, having worked hard, having invested?
But your tenants work hard as well.
Yeah, but I've invested in something and they haven't. And
but they're buying it for you.
No, they're not. They're not, James.
£1,200 they give you towards your £1,400 mortgage. You're only paying £200 a month for that.
I've got an interest-only mortgage, so I'm not buying the house with that money.
How on earth have you got outgoings of £1,200 then?
Sorry?
How can you have outgoings of £1,200? Is that just on the interest?
That's the interest, and there's service charge. It's a flat, so I have to pay service charge.
So you're keeping it there in the hope that it goes up, and when you sell it, you get all the money back.
Well, that's what I've been doing, but actually, the value's gone down.
But why
should I do it? Why would you want me to do it? To work hard to get a property, to rent it and be a good landlord? Why on earth?
I don't know if you are a good landlord.
I'm a good landlord.
I'm in favour. I'm not against landlords in general, but why are you against the rent freeze for 12 months during this particularly tricky time? Because you said yourself that you reduced your rent not long ago. So I don't know why you're getting upset about this. I think you'll be able to accommodate it quite easily. I don't think you need to worry.
You're joking.
No, I'm not. If you put rents down to, what was it, 2 years ago? 12 months ago?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And now they're just saying you can't put them up. So if you put them down a year ago, you're hardly likely to put it up again a year later. That would be grossly unfair on your tenant.
That's not very logical.
That's incredibly logical.
It's costing me £1,400 a month, and you're expecting me, a normal member of the public on a pension, to subsidise people that I like.
Yeah.
But why would I do that?
Because you are buying a house.
Yeah, but it's gone down in value. I've lost money.
Well, that's why I think you might not be very good at this landlording lark, Richard.
But that's because the government have brought in a whole load of rules. Did you know? A few years ago, the Conservatives brought in a rule where you can't claim the interest as a cost anymore?
Yes.
It depends on your tax band.
Yes.
So you can't even recoup the money you spend out on the interest.
We've got a category error. I look forward to having a tin of anchovies with you in the Black Dog at the first at the first opportunity. But we've got a category error here, because I'm looking at this objectively. I'm seeing landlord and tenant. You're seeing landlord exclusively, and some of the people who are blindly supportive of this because they just love it from a sort of Citizen Smith power to the people kind of point, we'll be seeing it exclusively through the lens of tenant. But this doesn't seem to me to be a particularly punitive suggestion. A freeze on what your status quo currently is for 12 months. That's what I mean. It doesn't seem to me as if they're coming after you or demanding that you hand over some of the money that you've already got or give some equity to your tenants. Just a rent freeze for 12 months as an act of national interest, as an act of social good. Become duty. That's the bit. I don't see it as being the guillotine that you seem to be visualising.
As an act of kindness, I reduced the rent 2 years ago from £1,400, which is what I had been getting, to £1,200 to help these tenants in the belief that I would keep them, I would avoid
agent's
costs.
And that's
but
it,
I can't
then.
Afford it anymore.
Oh, I see. So you need to put it up already before this was announced.
My fixed rate mortgage is coming to an end.
Yeah, so you do. So even before this was announced, you were going to have to put the rent up again.
And the building society won't listen to me and won't listen to you, saying, oh, let's have a freeze for a year or two.
And this is where I honestly don't know whether or not it's time to break out the world's tiniest violin, or to say, Rachel Reeves, you need to get back to the drawing board and come up with a better idea.
And the Tories, they're just as bad.
You must acknowledge, Rich, that won't somebody think of the landlords? It's quite a tricky refrain to be singing in the current climate.
Good landlords are providing good accommodation for people who can't afford to buy their own. And there are lots of unscrupulous
ones. Can afford to buy their own. They're buying it for you. They're meeting
When they were
paying £1,400 a month, they were meeting the interest payments on your mortgage. They just couldn't afford...
But not buying the house.
No, because they couldn't afford to... They couldn't afford to cobble a deposit together because their landlord was charging them so much rent.
So where else are they going to live?
Well, that's the question. I mean, that might be what happens. I think that's happening already as a consequence of the Renters' Rights Act. People are moving out of the sector. So something conceived politically in a good place ends up potentially having a very negative impact on the people it was designed to help. I mentioned this about 6 months ago because my friend Scott was looking for a new place to rent and saying loads of landlords are moving out of the market. This is going to be big in a few months' time. And it gets nearer. So I mean it. I mean, it's a good-natured exchange with Richard, not least because I might bump into him in the pub next weekend. But it is not necessarily a binary issue, this. If he ends up having to put his property on the market because it no longer is financially viable for him to be a landlord, to be renting it out, then his tenants get slung out, potentially. His tenants have to find somewhere new to live in an environment where landlords are moving out of the rental sector at a rate of knots. But, on the other hand, a temporary freeze on rents until the worst bits of the Iran war impacts pass is going to help a hell of a lot more people than it's going to hurt. And that is utilitarianism in action. So Richard becomes the negative utility. His plight is the price that society pays for the benefit that will be accrued by every tenant in the country. And depending, I suppose, on where your pendulum is at the moment, you will either be comfortable with that while, you know, sympathetic to Richard, or you'll be outraged by the very prospect and think that the greater number of tenants should suffer in order to protect him from the potential suffering of a rent freeze. 11:30 is the time. I told you this was interesting. And I hope you'd agree now, not obvious, not binary, actually. Here's Lottie Morley with your headlines.
Sir Keir Starmer's former chief of staff has told MPs he made a serious mistake in advising the Prime Minister to appoint Peter Mandelson. Morgan McSweeney is giving evidence about how Lord Mandelson became ambassador to the US last year. It's ahead of a vote by MPs to decide if Sir Keir Starmer should face a parliamentary inquiry. The King and Queen were greeted by Donald Trump and the First Lady at the White House at the start of their US state visit. King Charles is due to make an address to Congress later, where he's expected to praise the UK-US relationship. And the Education Secretary has denied the government will U-turn on plans for under-16s on social media. Ministers say they will push ahead with introducing restrictions, regardless of the outcome of a consultation. LBC weather turning brighter across England and Wales with some sunshine this afternoon, feeling cooler with a high of 20 degrees.
This is LBC. At Pets in a Pickle, we're here when it matters most. For fuss-free pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
A box of Abel and Cole fresh organic fruit and veg delivered weekly to your door. Requires washing, peeling and or chopping. Vegetables may come with mud and soil on and very occasionally a ladybird. All produce is grown ethically and with absolutely no artificial pesticides. Delivered without pointless plastic. Increased natural flavours in meals can lead to busier kitchen tables during peak hours, may lead to unexpected enthusiasm for cooking and distaste for processed food alternatives. Abel and Cole. Unprocess your food. Second helping subject to availability.
Fancy being spoilt for choice when it comes to your new kitchen? Wickes has over 80 kitchen styles and hundreds of cabinet options, so there's something for every home. Plus, choose from a wide range of leading appliance brands and beautiful worktops. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wickes.
Oh, you want weight loss advice?
Weight loss? Actually, what you want to do...
I got my weight loss secret from my mother, who got it from her mother's...
My tip is...
Weight loss?
Dragon fruit.
Podcast.
Advice.
Or you could go to MedExpress.
MedExpress. Healthcare without the noise. Go to medexpress.co.uk/weightloss.
Ali 60 milligram hard capsules contain orlistat for overweight adults with a BMI of 28 plus. Follow a reduced calorie, low fat diet. Always read the label.
When it comes to a bet on the football, we've all got our favourite thing. So whether you're a hatter, a shrimper, magpie, gunner or hammer, download the BetVictor app and find yours. If you're a villain, come and nick a bit of value. And if you're a blade, show us how sharp you are. For all your favourite things, visit BetVictor.
We simply remember our favourite things and then we'll feel so...
18 plus gambleaware.org. Please gamble responsibly.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So this is often what happens in the context of conversations about rent. We've never had one, I don't think, specifically about rent freezes before. But my switchboard tends to be populated by landlords pleading, if not poverty, then certainly they deserve to be treated differently from how many people perceive landlords. Well, my texts and tweets, or WhatsApps, in fact, become populated by people very, very much in the opposite camp. For example, Dom writes, who forced this poor man, talking about the last caller, Richard, who forced this poor man to be a landlord? It's just not fair. And then another, if he says he works hard again, you should electrocute him down the phone. And on it goes, including quite a few of you picking up on something I probably should have pointed out, which is that if it's an entirely interest-only mortgage on a buy-to-let property, then you are doing more damage to the property market or to the ability of younger people to get onto the housing ladder than I think anybody realises. But none of these are arguments that make a freeze on private sector rents a slam dunk. So I don't know. Is it time to tell Rachel Reeves to go back to the drawing board, or is it time to crack the world's tiniest violin out of its tiny little case? Stephen is in Snaresbrook. Stephen, what would you like to say?
Good morning.
Hello.
I have to say, absolutely love your show.
Oh, you're very kind.
Caller.
That's a good start. Well done. Carry on.
Now, I'm in a peculiar position in that I am both a landlord and a tenant.
Oh.
So I'm really not quite so sure about how I feel about this, because with my landlord hat on, I think that the rent freeze, particularly in my circumstances, which is similar to your previous caller,
yes,
would be quite disastrous when my mortgage comes up for renewal. I haven't put the rent up on the property that I rent out in 5 years.
But if your outgoings on that property increase, you would expect to pass some or all of that increase onto the people living in the property.
Yes. I would.
But that seems reasonable, doesn't it?
Yes, it does seem reasonable.
Until your current landlord needs to renew his or her current mortgage.
Exactly. So you can see that I've got one leg either side of the fence.
Yes, you have.
Because
also, we're going to offend everybody who rings in today, you're also not very good at this landlording lark.
No, because I became an accidental landlord.
Yes.
Which is why I rented out. I had to move because of personal circumstances.
Yes, I understand.
Couldn't sell the property that I was in within the time frame that I needed to move.
But equally needed to service the mortgage, so you had to get someone in to pay rent.
Exactly. And the lady that I have in there, my property is absolutely pristine. Obviously, you can't see it,
no.
But you'll have to take my word for it.
I do, yep. No reason to doubt you.
Absolutely pristine. And she loves being there. She's got a couple of boys. She couldn't afford the mortgage on a property that she needed for her family.
Yes.
So she rented out.
Well, she could, though, because she pays yours.
Well, exactly, but...
I just contradicted you, and you said exactly.
Exactly, but...
What?
It's not that she can't afford it.
Yeah.
She can afford the money.
Yeah.
Because she pays the rent every month.
Yes, exactly.
But...
So she can afford
she
to cannot buy a house.
But she can't afford to buy a house because she doesn't earn enough to get the mortgage that she requires...
Yes.
...to be able to purchase the property
to get
that
a deposit
she,
together.
To get the deposit together... Two, to get the mortgage.
Yeah.
For the amount of money that she would need.
That's the system that we inhabit. So, you're just going to do some sums then, aren't you? You're going to wait and see if your landlord increases it and you No, if your landlord is frozen and you're frozen as well, are you going to be better off or worse off than you are currently?
Well, I know that if I know that I'm going to be worse off because my mortgage comes to an end in November.
Right.
And it was on a particularly good rate.
Yeah.
And
this is all on Liz Truss. Or maybe not all on Liz Truss, but certainly I think we underestimate the impact she's had on these matters.
And also the tax regime punishes landlords.
Punish is a strong word.
It's the only sector where you can't claim your mortgage interest rate. It's the only business that you can't.
Is it getting the violin out now? Because I always think of it as being different from other businesses, and you don't. And that's fine. It's just a category disagreement, isn't it?
Yes, but that isn't how it used to be. You used to be able to claim your mortgage interest. And that, I think, is what is forcing rent up as well. I haven't increased my rent because of the current state. I said I'm not going to increase the rent.
But the property, it may not be in this current hiccup, and let's all hope it's a hiccup, but we're forgetting about the capital growth, aren't we, in this analysis from you?
There's been no capital growth on my property in 5 years. It's gone up, and it's gone back down again.
Yeah. I mean, that is unfortunate.
And that is, yes, you're absolutely right, is that that is what I put my eggs in the basket in relation to the capital growth, because I expected there to be capital growth, or even to one day move back into the property, because it's a lovely property.
Yes.
But that's where I put my eggs, and I've been hit.
And then you'd get hit again with a rent freeze and a remortgage. You'd be hit quite hard, and you know, I said this was going to happen, and I've got no idea how representative it is, Stephen. So you and Richard, you possibly a little bit more than Richard, make quite a strong case for giving the landlords a break. But on the other hand, people are queuing up in my inbox to express sarcastic sympathy for you while playing some of the world's tiniest violins. If you've never been a landlord, it feels very different from how it feels if you have. It feels like a sort of fruit machine that always comes up with three melons when you're a landlord. Like, you put 10p in, oh, look, I've won again. Oh, put 10p in, oh, look, I've won. I know you can't play fruit machines for 10p anymore, but you take my point. If you've never been a landlord, it looks like a hacked fruit machine. If you have been a landlord, it looks very different from that.
And with the whole change in the regime, I feel like now I'm trapped.
Yes.
I have that property, and in a sense, I have to keep it, because it's going to be very difficult to ask her to leave. Not that at this stage I would be even contemplating asking her to leave.
It becomes harder under the Renters' Rights Act. And how do you respond? Because you're really interesting, actually, because of the curious sort of fork that you're caught on. Just the very simple political principle that there will be a plurality of landlords who can suck this up quite easily, even if they want to plead difficulty, that they will be fine. And then there will be a minority of landlords like you who will be caught in quite a tricky little situation. But every single renter in the country is going to benefit from this. So from a utilitarian point of view, it's, you know, thank you, but tough to you.
Well, it's a case of the greater good, isn't it?
Yeah.
I suppose
is what you're
saying.
Yes, exactly what I'm saying. That's utilitarianism in a nutshell.
It's the greater good, but I've still got to think of me and my family as well.
And that is the fundamental flaw in utilitarianism.
I'm in a what you might call a reasonably paid job. Sure. I actually subsidise. In fact, I look upon it as subsidising the government, not subsidising the my tenant, because if I look at how much I receive in rent and how much I pay out in mortgage, and I can't claim that against my income tax, I've actually worked out that last year I paid £174 more in tax than I received actually the difference between the two. And when my mortgage comes around for renewal, and it will inevitably go up because of the interest rate change since then, I will be paying more towards that.
And that's
something that I'm prepared to suck up, because I'm in a reasonably well-paid
job. I could tell, yeah,
you're not a typical... not going to be in that position.
Not well, and they're certainly not going to be as community-minded as you are, or as patriotic as you are, actually, if you see it as a choice to not maximise your income, some of which, of course, could be subsidised by the state, in order to promote harmony in the lives of other people. Stephen, thank you. It's nuanced. I think it's really nuanced. I think it's more nuanced than I thought when I was a younger man. And for the record, I am not a landlord, although I have been. Like Stephen, by accident, which sounds a little bit with Nell and I. How can you be a landlord by accident? It's like that scene where Richard E. Grant and Paul McGann say, we've come on holiday by accident. I've become a landlord by accident. But the utilitarian argument is the one that suffers from the medium in which we're having this conversation, because a long queue of landlords making to varying degrees pleas for sympathy and understanding, and therefore the rejection of a rent freeze, is not representative of society. There'd be a much, much longer queue of tenants to whom, if you said, would you like a rent freeze, they would shout back, hell yes. Adam's in Wandsworth. Adam, what would you like to say?
Hi there, James. First time, big fan, a little nervous.
It's only me. You're very welcome.
I am a landlord, and my finances are in absolute tatters. There is nothing more that would help me than a rent increase to give me more money personally, and I still support the policy of freezing rents for tenants.
Gosh. I mean, if I were of a certain political complexion, happily I'm not, I'd point out, isn't it extraordinary that there's all these landlords are able to ring me when everybody else is down the pit doing a hard day's work? but you also sound like, in the capitalist tradition, you also sound like a rubbish landlord, because you're clearly not in it to maximise your income. Otherwise, you would be opposed to a rent.
No, I don't agree with that completely, James. You know, I do have a degree of self-interest, yes, and I do want to make an income. I think my point is that, you know, governments have to make rules and laws in generality.
Yes.
And in generality, we are an asset-owning class. We can afford to take a bit of a hit. And if we can't, we have an asset to sell.
Yes, and for every landlord who says, well, I can't, there will be 1,000 who can.
Then, yeah, if the rent doesn't give you the economic outcome you want, sell the asset.
And move along, move on.
Yeah.
So you are being selfless in your... You're being utilitarian, aren't you, actually?
It's been said that I have strong values, James. And
what a lovely thing to be said about you.
That is true.
What a lovely thing for people to say. Who said it? Your mum?
My therapist.
Well, then it's definitely true, Adam. That's a lovely thing to hear from anybody. But if you're hearing it from a therapist, then it's you can cash that check whenever you want. And you've proved it there, because this will, in the short term, impact negatively on me, but it will be for the betterment of the whole society, or at least for the greater good. And that's why I've said the word utilitarianism 7 times already this hour.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Pleased to say that the Conservative Party leader, Kemi Badenoch, is here to take your calls. Al is in Glasgow. Al, you're through to Kemi Badenoch.
I think that pursuing Keir Starmer is a waste of parliamentary time. We're facing dangerous crises. Perhaps you should withdraw your accusations that the PM lied.
Why would I do that? I mean, I believe that he has lied, and I've put the evidence out there. Now, you say that this is a waste of time. This is an inquiry led by a handful of MPs. Doesn't stop the Prime Minister doing his job. He's not going to be called in every 5 minutes. So why should we not know the truth? Because if he's lying to us about this, then what else is he lying to us about?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
A box of Abel and Cole fresh organic fruit and veg delivered weekly to your door. Requires washing, peeling and or chopping. Vegetables may come with mud and soil on, and very occasionally a ladybird. All produce is grown ethically and with absolutely no artificial pesticides. Delivered without pointless plastic. Increased natural flavours in meals can lead to busier kitchen tables during peak hours, may lead to unexpected enthusiasm for cooking and distaste for processed food alternatives. Abel and Cole. Unprocess your food. Second helping subject to availability.
On day 3 of leftovers for lunch, have a day off. Switch it up with a double cheeseburger for $2.49 on the McDonald's Saver menu.
Leftovers left the chat.
Talk about saver satisfaction. Served from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary. Fees apply to delivery orders. Subject to availability.
Ready for a new kitchen? Find the one at Wix. With kitchens for first homes and forever homes too. Visit Wix today.
Your time is valuable. Your perspective should be too. The Economist cuts through the noise with the stories that truly shape your world.
How can you believe that a new regime won't crush you just like the previous one?
Online scams are stranger than they've ever been.
When the world's turned upside down, know which way is up. Read, watch, or listen to The Economist.
Fever Tree Ginger Beer. There's no one quite like you, is there? That fiery character. Warming undertones. Mixed, you make a spirited Moscow Mule. But even on your own, you still have the most delectable kick. Fever Tree. Straight up or mixed. It's a matter of taste.
You've probably been with the same energy supplier for decades. And why wouldn't you be? Loyalty matters. But lately, bigger hasn't always felt better. You've probably dealt with long waits and endless automated menus in search of someone who can actually help. Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. Our people focus on the most important thing, you. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no, just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
It's 11:49. Morgan McSweeney still giving evidence to the Foreign Affairs Select Committee over the appointment of Peter Mandelson, something he began his testimony, if you weren't with us at 11 o'clock, by describing as a terrible mistake. So we'll let Aggie keep an eye on that and catch up with her when it is over. If I tell you that the conversation I want to have in the next hour speaks to a subject that used to be one of my all-time favourites, and in some ways still is, but is not one that I come around to anywhere like as often as I used to do. I wonder if those tiny, tiny little clues, someone who's been listening to the programme for a long time will be able to hazard a guess at what the subject might be. Remember, you can give yourself a bit of an advantage in that by having a look at the news and finding out what is in it. 10 to 12 is the time. This is it. Have I got anyone who's not a landlord saying, not me, please, spare me? Well, actually, that's not fair. The last lad was saying, yeah, of course it's going to hurt me personally, but I'm still in favour of the general good. Landlords, landlords, landlords. Landlords, landlords, landlords. Landlords to the left of me, landlords to the right of me. All right, not many landlords to the left of me, but you take my point. Steve's in Newcastle. Steve, what would you like to say?
Morning, James.
Hello, Steve.
I'd like to make one specific point to challenge something you said earlier on, and one general point, if I may.
Of course.
Yeah, sadly, I normally agree with you. On this occasion, I don't.
A landlord to the right of me.
Well, I've been one for 40 years.
Go on.
In which time I've had two tenancy disputes, so I must be doing something right.
Yes,
anyway.
Yes.
So, what you suggested was that the lady, the gentleman rang in and said, look, his tenant couldn't afford a mortgage on a property. And, and you said, well, yeah, but she's paying your mortgage. That may or may not be the case. The fact is that the outgoings on a property, it ain't just the mortgage. We're talking about council tax. We're talking about maintenance. The idea that buying a property, you pay your mortgage and there you go, you're all right, mate. One of the joys of renting a property from a decent landlord is it gets maintained and you don't pay anything.
You have no way of knowing whether he was a decent landlord or not.
Well, may I give you an example?
Also, if you rent a whole property, you normally pay your own council tax as a tenant.
Yeah, that entirely depends. But yeah, you do.
Entirely depends or you do. So let's park that one. Generally speaking, if you rent a whole property, a house or a flat, and you live in it as your main home, then you'll be paying the council tax yourself.
You pay the council tax. Okay. Yeah.
Sayonara to that observation.
Well, hang on.
Go on.
So I've just re-roofed a property in which there are four properties and a total of 15 occupiers. The roofing job was £24,000, for which the tenants, quite rightly, had to pay nothing. I'm not moaning or crying about it. I'm simply making the point that were they occupiers, they would have been paying for that. So that one of the benefits in renting from me is that they didn't have to. I also recently had to employ a drain jetting company to deal with the main sewer where there was a problem. Again, I don't expect any sympathy because I don't want any. But the fact owning a property isn't just about paying the mortgage.
No, and I don't going to have to put this quite diplomatically. I don't think anybody else listening to the programme thought that that's what I was saying.
Mm. Okay.
I mean, it's obvious, isn't it? I mean, anyone who's been a tenant knows what it's like, let alone anybody who's been a landlord. Obviously, there are outgoings that a landlord has while maintaining the property that he owns and somebody else pays him for the privilege of living in. I mean, that goes absolutely without saying. But we're back to Mr. McCorber territory, aren't we? Where, you know, if your income is a tiny bit lower than your outgoings, result happiness. If your income is a shilling higher than your outgoings, result misery. So the only point, really, at which this mooted rent freeze becomes controversial is if it moves your balance sheet from the black to the red. Because if all it does is reduce the black a bit, then, you know, you've got to suck it up, Steve.
Right. I'll suck up a rent freeze, but what is being ignored, of course, is the root and branch of the problem, which was that two successive governments, Labour, Tory and Labour, did not allow local authorities to retain the money from council housing that they were forced to sell off, which is why we're not building enough housing at non-market rent levels.
That's 110% true. Which Labour government did that, then? Blair's?
Well, they didn't change it. That was my argument.
Yeah,
you know, they had the chance to change it. They didn't change it. Blair and Brown failed to change it. The current government has failed to change it. And the previous Tory government failed to change it.
They absolutely should have changed it.
Yeah. Of course they should.
With you on. There you go. We part as friends, Steve. And you sound like a great landlord as well, for the record.
Well, I hope I am. That's what I've tried to be for 40 years.
And if you've got HMOs, which you have, I think, then you are, by definition, you are serving people who are not in the position to be able to buy a property for themselves under any circumstances.
Yeah.
Oh, good man. And that's the point. I say some people think I'm being tongue-in-cheek when I talk about nuance in the context of something as traditionally binary as landlord and tenant, but I'm not. I can say with a degree of certainty that the so-called think tanks that style themselves as academic institutions or researchers or centres for policy studies, they exist solely to protect wealth. And that is fine, as long as they're honest about it and tell you exactly who funds them. But it doesn't mean that all wealth is I knew you said rotten. All wealth is rotten. It doesn't mean that all wealth is rotten. It doesn't mean that everybody who is a landlord is a sort of, you know, Dickensian figure sucking the marrow from the bones of Tiny Tim's parents in order to fund their Qatar bolt hole. So, but a rent freeze is a binary suggestion. And it means that some people who we'd rather not see penalised are going to be penalised because more people are going to benefit. And I'm still there at 11:55. Chloe is in Lewisham. Chloe, what would you like to say?
Hi. Well, I agree with this policy, sort of.
Go on.
I'm a landlord. I'm also going to add that I have a kid at private school, because that was mentioned earlier.
You don't have to. What's your star sign?
No, it's relevant. It's relevant.
Okay, carry on then.
But what sort of niggles with me is I'm probably as left as you, maybe more so, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I feel that Labour is being a bit populist here.
Do you?
They're finding groups of unpopular people like landlords or private school parents, and that really they need to tax the wealthy more.
Mm.
And that's breaking a manifesto promise. But I think by singling out certain groups, you've got the problem you have with your previous caller, who you don't want to penalise him, you know?
I don't mind. It was a little bit more nuanced than some of the coverage allows, but I think Steve's good for the rent freeze. I don't think it's going to do him any harm. It's a bit odd, I think, to pick up your point. We heard in the news, was it BP's profits have gone up to about £7 gazillion? Pounds, and you hear that, and you think, hang on, why are they sticking VAT on my school fees and a rent freeze on my rental properties when BP just made $7 gazillion, squillion, billion, dillion dollars?
Yeah. And I look at the water industry and I look at the division of wealth increasing and I look at all these things. Now, I am in a middling high tax bracket. But I'd be happy to pay more tax if I then felt my kid, who's got some quirks, but is a well-behaved, nice boy, would get the education he needs and reach his potential in the state sector. He was in the state sector. I moved him because I was like, oh, God, this isn't working.
Okay.
And I'm privileged enough I can afford it. I've also had moments I've had to pay for private health or fought battles about SEN with the local authorities and paid lawyers. I'd just rather pay the tax.
And have a system that is fit for purpose for everybody, even...
Exactly.
To use your word, even the quirks in the system.
Exactly. And walk out the front door and feel society works. And I feel Labour is losing sight of its core base, partly because it doesn't want to go against its manifesto pledge of not raising tax.
Right.
But I feel they need to, because the division of wealth is so extreme. It's causing divisions. It's divisive. We don't need more of that. And
the problem is that with a few obvious exceptions, like BP, which isn't a person, nobody thinks they're wealthy. I was taking the mickey on Blue Sky yesterday out of another one of those articles in the Mail or the Telegraph saying something like, I earn £155,000 a year, but I'm not wealthy. And, of course, that may be true in one sense, but somebody reading that who earns £25,000 a year is going to collapse in fits of hysterical laughter, aren't they? When you say they've got to raise taxes, whose taxes do we mean? The thresholds are already, compared to other countries, quite punitive for high earners. It's because we don't tax wealth, we don't tax assets as effectively as we could. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, and they've brought things like capital gains taxes getting a bit better addressed.
Yes.
But I do think you've got this asset class where there's a massive problem, and you need to increase the capital gains tax on the income they're receiving from those assets.
And not maybe go after small property landlords, like landlords and landladies with just one or two properties. It's not either or, you can do both, but if you're not doing the other
but it feels a bit like the private school fees, so let's single out that group, when really what you're doing is putting a wealth tax.
I think that was ideological as well. I think that was ideological as well as financial. I think moving society towards a place where privilege and wealth does not actually allow you to give your children things that other children don't get was born of the same principle that makes you want to pay more tax, to have a system where everybody gets a fair crack of the whip, oddly. The problem is this, and I don't know enough, we must have another conversation about this another day, but one of the reasons why you're never going to have really meaningful legislation regarding property and landlords is the royal family and the Duke of Westminster and all of the enormous swathes of the country that are owned by people who came over with William the Conqueror in 1066. If you think you're going to be able to turn that upside down, then I've got a bridge I want to sell you, although the Labour government will chip away at elements of it and is doing so. And then similarly, I think you also have a problem when you talk about a wealth tax or asset taxes. Is it that we don't, you kind of, who? I mean, is the people with loads and loads of money are going to pay a few quid to cover it in loopholes and offshores and trusts and all that sort of thing? So it will end up being you and me that pay the wealth tax again on what assets we have, while people who've got 100 times more than us, will, like the Duke of Westminster, who's probably got 1 million times more than us put together, they'll be fine. They won't even pay inheritance tax.
Yeah, and that's my issue.
That's my issue too.
That the middle class get more and more squeezed, and the wealth gap gets bigger and bigger, and the people earning 120,000 or whatever in London feel they're poor because London housing costs and everything are so insane that they end up believing that, even though the person who's earning 25 grand, I don't know, in rural Lincolnshire is going, what the hell do you mean?
Yeah, and watching it on their payslip disappear down what they think is a plug hole, which of course we know it isn't a plug hole, but it certainly feels that way when you're seeing a significant slice of it disappear every month. Thank you, Chloe. You'll never guess who I had a similar conversation with about 3 months ago.
Well,
you'll never guess. Yeah. Go on, have a go.
Oh, I don't know. I listened to you quite erratically in snippets in the car.
It wasn't on the radio. It was privately. I went to a fancy dinner.
Oh.
He's American.
Gary's economics, man.
I know.
Scaramucci.
Yes, it was Scaramucci.
Yeah, look at that.
The Mooch himself was making very similar points to you.
He had a brilliant line yesterday about when his parents got the first washing machine.
Yes.
Like Granny and Mum, and he lived in a multi-generational house, and he came home, and he was about 5 or 6, and it was like one of the happiest days of his life, because everyone was so excited. And it was all about how they could afford to no longer walk to the laundrette and how their kids were going to college and how they were blue-collar aspirational.
Well, that's where he's coming
from. Yeah, and the problem that's now occurred is you've got blue-collar desperational, he called it.
That's strong.
And it's exactly that.
Yes.
It's a massive problem. And I'm your age, exactly. In fact, very similar to you. Irish connection, boarding school, la-da-la.
There we go.
And I just look back to where I grew up. I went, go, hang on, the 1970s was so much more equal, so much more equal. Yes, I was still privileged within it.
The gap was the gaps were much smaller, and the slightly unbelievable levels of wealth that seem to be dominating discourse now were, I mean, they still existed. You still had the Duke of Westminster and the Duke of wherever else and all of the 1066 families, but it didn't feel as if society was attuned to maximise their finances as opposed to everybody else's. I'm only cracking on because of the news and because I'm still slightly gobsmacked that you managed to call that correctly. It was absolutely first class. Thank you, Chloe. We'll talk again.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Sir Keir Starmer's former chief of staff has told MPs he made a serious mistake advising the Prime Minister to appoint Peter Mandelson. Morgan McSweeney is giving evidence about how Lord Mandelson became ambassador to the US last year. He told the Foreign Affairs Select Committee he didn't let personal connections impact his judgments.
I don't regard Mandelson as a hero. I think that's an exaggeration of the kind of relationship that I had with him. In every advice that I gave to the Prime Minister, hand on heart, I thought I was operating with a motive in a national interest. In 20 years in politics, I've had to fire friends from jobs. I've had to turn people down who were desperate for jobs, who were closer friends of mine than Mandelson.
Sir Keir has asked his backbenchers to stand together during a vote later. MPs will decide if he should face an inquiry to see whether he misled Parliament over Mandelson's vetting. The King will address Congress later on the first full day of his four-day state visit to the US. Charles and Camilla enjoyed tea at the White House after landing in Washington yesterday evening. The leader of the Conservatives has accused the government of doing a U-turn on plans for social media for under-16s. Ministers had said they weren't considering it, but now say they could bring a ban in, depending on the outcome of a consultation. Kemi Badenoch has told LBC it's the latest in a string of U-turns from Labour.
The Prime Minister has led them up the garden path so many times. Oh, he's not going to ban phones in schools. Now they're doing it. They don't want to ban social media for children. Now, yesterday, looks like they're doing it. They're taking away winter fuel, and everybody has to vote for that. Then they had to reverse it. They were going to cut welfare. Then they reversed that.
BP is facing criticism after revealing its profits more than doubled in the first 3 months of this year due to the war with Iran. Thanks to surging oil prices, the energy giant saw its profits increase to £2.4 billion between January and March. The company says it's helping to ensure the UK has enough fuel supplies. And a man has admitted plotting a terror attack on a Taylor Swift concert in Vienna. The plan was thwarted, but three shows planned in the city nearly 2 years ago were cancelled anyway. The 21-year-old faces up to 20 years in prison. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 49 points at 10,370. The pound buys $1.35 and a euro 15. LBC weather turning brighter across England and Wales with some sunny spells this afternoon, a high of 20 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
Next.
Hi, just these, thanks. Do you do cashback?
Just need to check you're not a robot first. New security policy.
Okay.
How many traffic lights can you see out the window?
Oh, two?
No, that's wrong.
Right, well, obviously I'm not a robot.
That's what a robot would say.
What a load of malarkey. Smarty keeps things simple, like 80 gigabytes for £10. And on a rolling monthly SIM plan, you're free to leave any time. Less malarkey, more Smarty. Search Smarty Mobile.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Oh,
6 is the time, slightly busy hour. Aggie Chambray will be with us at 12:30 to bring us up to speed with what's happened at the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, where Morgan McSweeney was giving his evidence regarding the Peter Mandelson situation, the vetting and the various claims and counterclaims that have typified this story. And then the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, will join us at 12:45. I wonder if he knows that thing we were talking about yesterday about how London is the only place in the United Kingdom where the healthy life expectancy is going up at the moment, has gone up over the course of the last 10 years, where for everywhere else in the country, it has gone down by an average of 2 years. He's going to be explaining why, warning that Londoners could be more highly exposed to the march of AI than any other region, according to a new report. So more on that a little later. Speaking of London, it's becoming a bit of a... it's really odd to me that I find myself having to do this. I was out again in London last night, and my goodness me, the vibe was beautiful. I don't normally spend much time around the Westminster part of town. I like going into the West End. I get out in the West End once or twice a week. But I was around Westminster, and there were two or three things going on that reminded me why this is the best city in the world. One was the number of people who still had their medals on. They'd gone out to take in the sights, people from outside London, and in some cases, I think, from overseas, on the day after the London Marathon, but they were still wearing their medal. I saw a bunch of four people looking at the pelicans in St. James's Park, and they all had their medals on, and there was just a real, I'm never going to run a marathon. There's no prizes for that observation or prediction, but it's such an extraordinary achievement. Yeah, I'm sure I'm never going to run a marathon. It's such an extraordinary achievement, isn't it? And the joy that was still being felt by these people and conveying to others as they made their way around London. And then in Parliament Square, just outside the House of Commons, where I was attending a function, I'd never seen this before. I've lived in London for, good Lord, a very long time. I'd never seen people queuing up outside the House of Commons simply to, like, a self-styled queue. There's no one organising the queue or presiding over the queue. It's just tourists queuing up to take their photographs either alongside or in red phone boxes. So there's, like, decommissioned red phone boxes just off St. Stephen's Green. And there was a queue. One of the queues had about 8 or 9 people in it just taking turns to get to the front and take a picture. And then, of course, you've got all the people on the Green itself photographing the House of Commons or the House of Lords, the Houses of Parliament. You've got a lot of Big Ben stuff going on, people posing, in a special way like you do at the Leaning Tower of Pisa where you pretend you're propping it up. It's just lovely. And it's odd because I'd never noticed how wonderful this stuff is when people, racist liars on social media, weren't pretending that London is awful. I don't know whether it's a backfire effect, because I presume racist liars on social media are still garnering loads of support from other racist liars. But since this weird misrepresentation of our country in general, but our city in particular, has gained so much traction, and you speak to Americans in particular, who are persuaded of all sorts of madnesses, all sorts of nonsense, you probably don't notice how good things are until you're noticing how wrong the racist liars are. London, absolutely wonderful. Last night, it's a bit colder again today. It was also clement weather. That's the third part of the triangle, probably last night. You've got the post-marathon, you've got the lovely tourists, and then you've got the rather clement weather that meant everyone was wandering around in their shirt sleeves. 12:10 is the time. As Dr. Johnson famously observed, if you're tired of London, you are tired of life. I like this story a lot, but I am going to need your help with it. I've told you a few times, if you're relatively new to the programme, you may struggle to believe, because you probably think I'm still quite obnoxious. But I used to be really obnoxious. And I had a few pet subjects where my obnoxiousness was off the charts. I've told you before, sadly and to my shame, obesity was one of them. But also, on a slightly less serious note, things like tattoos and pet ownerships, veganism and vegetarianism. I used to be performatively obnoxious on these subjects, in that I didn't think too deeply about them. I adopted a strong position that provided weapons with which me to bop you over the head if you were unduly fond of your pets, or you were a vegan or a vegetarian.
vegetarian, or you were obese, or you were a long list of things, heavily tattooed, and I'd be really, really rude in what I thought was quite an amusing fashion. And many people took it in good heart or good spirit, but some people got really, really upset with me. And to my enduring embarrassment and shame, that didn't really affect me very much until it did. And that's why I don't do it anymore. There are a few little signs on that path, a few little milestones on that path. I think the fella that got in touch with me when I'd been going off on one of my riffs about how your dogs would eat you if you were dead on the sofa, they'd be tucking into your toes within 24 hours. And a chap got in touch very simply by email to say, just to let you know that if it wasn't for my Dachshunds, my wife died 6 months ago, I don't think I would have got through it without them. And I suddenly thought, why have you made this dude feel bad? And he's not exactly having a great time of it at the moment. Why have you made him feel bad about how much he loves his dogs and how much they love him? So I stopped doing that. And there was a nurse who said to me, I was top of my class at paediatric nursing, and I'm covered in tattoos. You bring a child into A&E, who do you want to look after you, the best nurse there or the one with the least tattoos? And I thought, yep, James, you're an idiot. The obesity stuff, rather more profound moments of recognising that you have become something of a bully and that is not pretty. The other one, I wonder if you can remember or if you have worked it out. I used to get so, so up on my high horse about marriage. And of all of those subjects that I've just run through, that sort of quick guided tour of my hopefully abandoned bigotries, marriage is the one that I still struggle with. I still struggle not to be that person. I don't think, or at least I hope, I won't be performatively obnoxious about it by saying things like, well, he obviously doesn't love you as much as I love my wife, otherwise he would have wanted to marry you. Or she's obviously keeping her options open, otherwise you'd have been up the aisle by now. And that kind of slightly lazy, what would the word be? A provocation. That slightly lazy provocation. But two things make it different, I think, from the other subjects. The first is the number of people who've got in touch with me, including people who've become friends of mine as a consequence of us meeting through the programme, who used to think I was absolutely ridiculous when I waxed lyrical about how marriage was the gold standard of relationships and everything else was by some measure inferior. People who used to think that was a ridiculous and obnoxious position, getting in touch with me subsequently to say that they have got married and I was right all along. And I'm not being a wally. I can think of three people off the top of my head who fall into that category. So that gives me pause, because I don't think anyone is ever going to make me think that I was right all along about the other issues that I just shared with you. And the other element of this is that I haven't shed my gut feeling, which will not be there for rational or logical reasons. It will be there for emotional reasons. It will be there for long-distant childhood-related issues and the things that form our opinions that have nothing to do with facts or evidence and everything to do with feelings. And I still have this sense that marriage is something worth cherishing, worth protecting, worth championing in the context of all other relationships. And if it is, if marriage is worth doing all of those things, then it can only be because it is, quotes, better, end quotes, than other relationship statuses. No? Well, I think so. And I'm a bit embarrassed that I still think that. But I kind of do. And then we come to a story today that says cohabiting couples are demanding the same rights as those who are married, as more people choose to live together without tying the knot. So it's a poll of more than 2,000 people that has found 60% believe that unmarried couples should have the same rights as those who marry to leave assets to each other free of inheritance tax. 52%, oh my lord, it's 52%, said that cohabiting couples should be eligible for the rights enjoyed by married people within the first 5 years of living together. It's commissioned by a law firm, and it's been done by YouGov, who are a reputable polling company. And I don't get it. I just don't get it. If you want to be married, get married. No? If you want to have the rights and privileges that marriage bestows upon a relationship, then you get married, right? If you're not ready to get married, but you want to be together, you can cohabit, you can move in together. But society reserves special treatment for married couples. And the egalitarian in me should really balk at this. What's it, just a meaningful piece of paper? Why on earth does it matter? What do we need for this? I kind of see that intellectually, but this story, I think, allows me to revisit this territory without offending anybody. You don't have the same status. There's not really any such thing as being a common law spouse. And some people discover this in the most hideous and tragic of circumstances. You're not recognised by the legal system. You don't have the same rights and protections as married couples. And I kind of struggle to join the next dot on this page, which is, well, hang on, I want the same rights and privileges as married couples. I want the same rights and protections as married couples, to which there's a really easy solution, right? Get married. Oh, I don't want to get married. Well, then you don't want to have the rights and protections that marriage bestows. Yeah, no, I do. Oh, okay, good. Get married then. No, but I don't want to get married. But I want to have the rights and protections that marriage bestows. Well, that's fine. You can have them. You just get married. No, but I don't want to get married. Well, what do you mean you don't want to get married? What does marriage mean? If it doesn't mean the bestowal of rights and protections under our legal system that you don't get in any other circumstances. And you know, what if you move out on a Friday night, you move in with someone new on a Saturday? Who's got the rights then? That's a slight exaggeration or simplification of the system. But you move out of one relationship on a Saturday night, you move in with your new partner on a Sunday morning. Who are you married to? Who has the equal rights and protections? The person you left on Saturday or the person you moved in with on Sunday? Now, if you're getting divorced and married, those questions are really easy to answer. But if you're not, they're impossible to answer. I accept I might sound a bit old, and I accept I might sound a little bit out of touch, but I also want you to acknowledge that I genuinely sound confused. Why would you not do it? What would the obstacle be? People living together demand same rights as married couples is a bloody great headline in the Times newspaper, to which I can't help thinking the answer is staring us in the face. People living together demand same rights as married couples. Oh, that's fine. Yeah, cool. Get married. So, what's wrong with my analysis? 0345 6060 973. I must be missing something here. Why would you not want to get married, but you would be sufficiently certain that you've made all the right choices, that you deserve the rights and protections that currently, under our legal system, only marriage can bestow? What is it that is happening in this story? I really want to have all of the benefits of marriage. Great, get married. No, I don't want to get married. I just want all the benefits of marriage. Oh, my God, it's sounding like Brexit. Isn't it? I don't want to be in the European Union. I just want to have all the benefits of being in the European Union. There's a word for people like you. You're an idiot. You can't have all the benefits of being in the European Union if you've left the European Union. Whatever Nigel Farage and Jacob Rees-Mogg might have told you, it was obvious from the start that you weren't going to be able to carry on using the rowing machine and the sauna after you'd cancelled your membership at the bloody gym. Oh, no, but I want to be married. I don't want to be married. I just want to have all the come on, I've got a sense that I am missing something here, because otherwise it wouldn't have been such a big story. But what exactly am I missing? 0345 6060 973. More and more people living together without being married. I mean, you can have a civil partnership as well. There's lots of things you can do to enjoy all of the... You don't have to go up the aisle in Westminster Abbey or anything like that. What on earth is going on? It doesn't have to be a religious contract anymore either. So all of the options are in place for you to enjoy all of the rights and protections of marriage without any of the historic problems with religion or patriarchy or whatever it may be. Why? Why would you not want to get married if you want to have all the rights and protections of being married? 0345 6060 973 is the number you need. It's 20 past 12.
This is LBC.
Calling all young creatives. Kickstart your career in media. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12 at Global Academy. Globalacademy.com.
Your time is valuable. Your perspective should be too. The Economist cuts through the noise with the stories that truly shape your world.
How can you believe that a new regime won't crush you just like the previous one?
Online scams are stranger than they've ever been.
When the world's turned upside down, know which way is up. Read, watch, or listen to The Economist.
Shine Night Walk London is a 10K, half marathon or full marathon supported walk around the city at night on the 19th of September to raise vital money for Cancer Research UK. It's also...
everyone walking with all their colours, twinkling away.
We can actually see how nice London is. And London is different at night time.
Celebration of life, and it gives hope.
Step towards a brighter future at shinewalk.org today to get 30% off your entry. Together, we are beating cancer. T's and C's apply.
Fancy being spoilt for choice when it comes to your new kitchen? Wix has over 80 kitchen styles and hundreds of cabinet options, so there's something for every home. Plus, choose from a wide range of leading appliance brands and beautiful worktops. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wix.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
It's 12:22. When I predicted that the imminent collapse in immigration to this country would provide a very brief problem for racist provocateurs, and they would inevitably turn their attention to the welfare state next, I wasn't expecting the Tony Blair Institute to join in. A very disappointing story from them. You're much better off listening to the spokespeople for MenCap and similar charities quoted in the same stories in the news today. But it's almost an unhinged headline, because I hate to tell you this, I am going to be proved completely correct, and that people who are in receipt of disability benefits, sickness benefits, personal independent payments, they're going to be the new immigrants. You are, and I'm very sorry about this, you are going to be the people who everybody else is encouraged to hate and blame for the fact that they haven't got as much money as they think they should have. And if you're a young person with ADHD or depression or crippling anxiety, I know how hard it is to get a PIP assessment, but loads of people who don't care about how hard it is, or pretend not to understand how hard it is because they need to attack somebody, it's what their job is, they're coming for you. But I wasn't expecting the Tony Blair Institute to join in. And what's extraordinary about the way this so-called research has been conducted is that it reports only that loads of people believe the benefit system is too easy to game. It provides no proof whatsoever that it is too easy to game. It simply reports that lots of people believe it is, which is a little bit like reporting that lots of people believe it would be a good idea to leave the European Union, which was true. They did. But they were completely wrong. It's not a story to say that people who have been carefully groomed and gaslit into believing things that are not true believe things that are not true. But you will encounter, if you haven't already, deeply irresponsible people who will pretend that this research is somehow evidence of something that it isn't even claiming. It is simply describing a state of affairs in which people have been persuaded to believe something. So just keep your eyes and ears open for that as we turn our attention to the bizarre question of why you wouldn't get married if you really, really want to have the rights and protection that only marriage can provide. There you go. Don't know why it took me 20 minutes to do that. Could have done it in two. Ashley's in Swindon to kick things off. Ashley, what would you like to say?
Hi there, James. Sorry, standard, nervous first-time caller, long-time listener.
It's only me.
It's only me,
et cetera, et cetera. Carry on.
So I've been engaged now for just over a year. I would say, so from my experience, I would say that the main thing is probably the cultural and societal expectations of you having the big, lavish wedding. You obviously invite everyone. It has to be a big do and everything like that. So I'm thinking it's cost, essentially, when we're living in a cost of living crisis at the moment.
Yes.
I think that's holding a lot of people back. So I do absolutely believe marriage is,
But how would this work? How would this work? So if you and your fiancé were to be afforded the rights and protections of marriage, what would you have to do to activate that?
What do you mean, sorry?
Well, because, I mean, God forbid that she leaves you tomorrow and moves in with Keith.
Yes.
I know, you're right to laugh. Yeah. But still, would those rights and protections be immediately transferred to the new relationship? Would they now be in the... What threshold has to be met in order for you to achieve the rights and protections that marriage would convey, but your fiancé wouldn't get them if she moved... She wouldn't get them tomorrow if she up sticks and moved in with Keith in the morning.
So my point is to why the barrier's there in the first place,
But you've got to answer the question. I mean, I understand some of the barriers. I did these phone-ins 20 years ago and people would say, it's too expensive, or I blame Jordan because everyone expects a Cinderella carriage now and £250,000 worth of hospitality and I can't do this. And there's some truth in that, and it is expensive, but no one is forcing you to do it on a Hello magazine scale or anything like that.
Well, I think what I'm trying to say is that there needs to be almost like a culture. It's not happening.
I'm just laughing at Keith, actually, poor fellow.
I think there needs to be like a cultural societal change, like in attitude, so people do feel they can just go up to a registry office, just sign the papers, and there you go, you got it.
Yeah, so you're agreeing with me.
I am agreeing with you, absolutely. Yeah. I just wanted to bring that into the conversation, which is why...
So do you think you might do that then, given that presumably the sort of fairy tale wedding feels a little bit further out of reach than you were expecting it to?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. As I said, I do agree with you. I just wanted to bring that into the conversation. I think because of how people view what weddings are meant to be like, we see all these lavish weddings on all these reality TV programs and whatnot.
Yes.
And I think that's what people expect, and that's what's putting people off. So I don't think it's an unwillingness to actually get married. I think it's an unwillingness to basically fund it.
Well, you say that. I mean, it will be in some people's cases, but they can't. But if they want the rights and protections of marriage, I guess you're possibly right that everybody just is intending to do it one day, but just when they can afford to do it on a much grander scale than they currently can. But there's more to it than that. There's no way these numbers would be where they were unless there was a weird mindset. In my view, it's weird, and I'm happy to be disabused of that conclusion, that you deserve all the rights and protections of marriage despite not being in any way, shape or form married, because the obvious problem with that is the threshold that has to be met for those protections and rights to kick in. And as Ashley says, there's nothing to stop you going down the road, picking up a witness in Wetherspoons, popping into the local registry office, and you'd be married by tea time. And then you get all the rights and protections. And if you want to have a massive party in 10 years' time, then have a massive party in 10 years' time. And then I worry I'm sounding like Ian Duncan Smith, because, of course, I'm worried about marriage itself being diluted or denuded or tarnished. And that's when I do begin to feel a bit ridiculous. Ashley, great call. I apologise for planting that hideous seed in your mind, but I can assure you you've got nothing to worry about. Kieran's in Hackney. Kieran, what would you like to say?
Hi, James.
Hello.
First-time caller, long-time listener, and, big fan.
Top man.
To be honest, I thought my first call, if I ever called, would be to air my theories on Brexit. But,
second call, Kieran. Second call.
Go. Okay, sure. It's a date. So you... I just have to... I want people to... the reason, surely... for people both wanting to get married and not wanting to get married, which you don't seem to have gotten into, is divorce.
No, it's not. Well, actually, you should tell me why. Well, because this wouldn't change that. If you've got the same rights and protections as married couples, then when you split up, you'd have the same rights and protections as a divorcing couple.
It's not about getting the rights to... the pain and difficulty of breaking up when you are married versus the non-pain and pain and difficulty, but greatly, greatly reduced when you're not married.
And you're talking about the emotional impact rather than any of the logistical or financial.
I'm talking about the emotional and the financial impact.
I mean, this is why I did push back a little at the outset, because I don't think that the financial impact would be any different if you had the full recognition of rights and protections as married couples, but the idea of
not necessarily. It depends where you are.
I'm reading the story in front of me, which is simply saying that they want to be treated identically to cohabitants. Want an identical status to their married counterparts, and that will be about rights and protections, which are going to be most obviously financial. So assets to each other free of inheritance tax, and then in the context of divorce, divides would be similar. But we can park that as a known unknown.
I think it's because it's not made completely clear what...
No, I hadn't. You're right. I hadn't contemplated what you're describing. And that is the sense that if you think that you're in it for the long haul and you commit in every way except maritally, then when things hit the buffers, it's going to somehow be more manageable than it would be if you had committed maritally?
You're simply marriage. Marriage is a way of, for certain people, or for maybe for a lot of people, of... Well, circumventing trust, and making it harder and feeling safer to be with someone for the long term, and making it harder to split up and feeling safer.
So, are you? And forgive me if I'm misunderstanding. Are you saying that people might not want to get married because they don't want to put that level of trust in someone else?
No, I'm saying. Well, you can see it from both ways, can't you?
Yes, I can.
They might not want to get married because they do trust someone enough not to get married.
I think I understand what you're saying. I think I feel I'm doing a bit of a disservice by not understanding it better. I don't know if that's my fault or yours.
I've been thinking. I phoned mainly because I've been. It's just something that I've been thinking about.
Yeah,
a fair amount. And it just feels like. I mean, for some people, marriage is a declaration of trust. So you're saying, I want to be with you forever. But for other people, it might be the opposite. It might be, well, you need this because you want it. It makes it more difficult.
Yes.
For us to end our relationship if one of us changes or if, you know, as things often
But I think you're answering a slightly different question. I think you're explaining why some people might not want to get married. You're not explaining why some people who don't want to get married want the same rights and protections as married couples.
I don't want to get married.
Exactly. But I want the same rights and protections as a married couple. You don't want those.
I don't think they want all the same. I mean,
we're back to the known unknown. I think I get it. I think
there is a point to be made about
clearly.
How much people want marriage for that reason or don't want marriage for that reason, and therefore they feel that marriage is maybe. It's not necessarily purely ideological.
No, I hear you. I think I do. I think in some ways your call is a companion piece to Ashley's, actually, as a call for society's impositions and expectations to be changed or to be dialed down and diluted because of the heft that a commitment of marriage carries for good or for ill. And you remind us that sometimes it will be for ill. Kieran, thank you. That's a brilliant debut. I look forward to your call on the wriggles of Brexit. Matt Hewitt is here first with your headlines.
Sir Keir Starmer's former chief of staff has told MPs he made a serious mistake advising the Prime Minister to appoint Peter Mandelson. Morgan McSweeney's told the Foreign Affairs Committee that discovering the extent of Lord Mandelson's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein was a knife through my soul. The peer has denied any wrongdoing. The King and Queen will head to a ceremonial welcome with the Trumps in around an hour as they start the first full day of their US state visit. Charles will also address the US Congress later. And the mother of a murdered teenage girl says Britain can learn from Australia's social media ban for children. Esther Jai says UK restrictions could be made more effective than those down under, as ministers confirm they'll bring in some kind of age or functionality limits. LBC weather, cloud clearing to leave a sunny day for most, a few showers for the southwest and northern isles, feeling cooler, highs of 11 to 17 degrees.
This is LBC.
If you were missold a home on a holiday park, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive compensation. Text ADVICE to 78900.
Fever Tree Mediterranean Tonic Water. Who are you? Usually the mixer. The tea in G&T. But your delicate fragrance, hints of lemon thyme. When the tea's this good, do you even need the G? Fever Tree, straight up or mixed. It's a matter of taste.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
You've probably been with the same energy supplier for decades. And why wouldn't you be? Loyalty matters. But lately, bigger hasn't always felt better. You've probably dealt with long waits and endless automated menus in search of someone who can actually help. Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. Our people focus on the most important thing, you. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no, just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, energising a better Britain.
12:36 is the time. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. We may return imminently to elements of this conversation about marriage. So for example, some of the answers. It costs £10,000 to £15,000 to get married, James. It doesn't. Cost £10,000 to £15,000 to have a certain type of wedding, which is why I'm confused by the number of people who want to have the rights and protections of marriage without having a marriage. And I'm still confused, despite really powerful calls. But Aggie Chambray has been observing events at the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. You're too busy to listen to this programme every day. I fully accept that. So you're probably not aware of Osborne's razor.
I actually am not.
Yeah, that's fine. Osborne's razor was invented by a listener to this programme called James, not me, and it posits the idea that whenever we are discussing a particular problem in our country, many roads will lead back to George Osborne. Now, usually this applies to austerity, but bizarrely it also applies to today's evidence from Morgan McSweeney to the Foreign Affairs Select Committee about the appointment of Peter Mandelson to the ambassadorship to the United States of America. Tell me more.
Indeed, there is this alternative timeline where George Osborne is picked as the ambassador instead of Peter Mandelson, and everything would just be going swimmingly.
The two, that's it. That's the country. That's what this government could come up with.
And
two,
apparently
two
George
characters, the man arguably more responsible than any other for the financial climate that we currently inhabit. I give Liz Truss the nod on that one. But the man who shut the Sure Start centres, the libraries, who denuded social capital from every corner of the country, he was option one, and the paedophile's friend was option two.
And apparently, actually, George Osborne was the preferred option, at least for a while. But Peter Mandelson won out.
Yeah. What else have we learned?
Well, Morgan McSweeney has been talking about that and so much more. The former chief of staff, of course, to the Prime Minister, speaking at the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. And he began his appearance just after 11 a.m. with a pre-prepared statement.
The appointment of Mandelson as ambassador was a serious error of judgment. I advised the Prime Minister in support of that appointment, and I was wrong to do so. As I said in my resignation statement, I resigned because I believe responsibility should rest with those who make serious mistakes. Accountability in public life cannot apply only when it is convenient. The Prime Minister relied on my advice, and I got it wrong. It is also important, however, to distinguish between what I did do and what I did not do. What I did do was make a recommendation based on my judgment that Mandelson's experience, relationships and political skills could serve the national interest in Washington at an important moment. That judgment was a mistake. What I did not do was oversee national security vetting, ask officials to ignore procedures, request that steps should be skipped, or communicate explicitly or implicitly that checks should be cleared at all costs.
So Morgan McSweeney sat there saying that the appointment of Peter Mandelson was a serious error of judgment. He, of course, saying there, and it has been reported previously, he very much recommended Lord Mandelson. They'd been friends for a long time. But he also said, when asked questions by members of the committee, that it wasn't just him who was pushing for Peter Mandelson.
If the Prime Minister was hearing overwhelmingly against Mandelson, he might have made another decision. But he was getting a lot of views at the time. He was listening to people. He does listen to his senior staff. He does listen to his ministers before reaching a decision. So I think if it was just me arguing for it, I don't think he'd have made that appointment.
He was also asked, James, who put Lord Mandelson's name forward first. And he said, which did elicit some laughter from the committee, I think the first person to put Mandelson's name forward was Mandelson. He talked to many people, making it clear he was interested in the job. But On a more serious note, he also talked about the relationship between Jeffrey Epstein and Lord Mandelson, and said some of it really, really took him by surprise when that came out after he'd already been appointed.
The nature of the relationship that I understood he had with Epstein was not a close friendship. How I understood it at the time was a passing acquaintance that he regretted having, and that he apologised for. What has emerged since then was way, way, way worse than I had expected at the time. And it was when I saw the pictures, when I saw the Bloomberg questions in September 2025, I have to say it was like a knife through my soul. I did not expect that level of connection that he was talking about there.
Saying a knife through his soul to see some of those revelations about the relationship that had endured between Jeffrey Epstein and Lord Mandelson. And as well, I should say, in that statement at the very beginning, he did begin with an apology to the victims of Epstein too, and said that he was sorry if any part of the controversy made this worse for them. Elsewhere, James,
yes.
He said that Lord Mandelson was not his hero. He said he wasn't trying to get a job for him. But he also admitted there wasn't a contingency plan. So had they known that Lord Mandelson did not pass developed vetting, there was no contingency plan. He said probably they would have asked Karen Pearce to stay on, and admitted it would have been embarrassing to pull him after that.
If Mandelson's DV had been a problem, it would have been an embarrassment for us. It would have been a much bigger problem for him. But there's an alternative scenario, which is that we had... say we're going to do DV before we talk to the palace or before we talk to the US administration. The chances of, unfortunately, the chances in government of there being a leak anyway would have been a problem. Either way, if your lead candidate fails DV, it is embarrassing, but it's far preferable to pull that candidate at that point than to go any further.
He also did say that he didn't feel he'd got the full truth back from Peter Mandelson on his links to Jeffrey Epstein. Yes, clearly. But he was appointed anyway, conditional on developed vetting, which, of course, we know it wasn't actually the case. And Lord Doyle was brought up. We talked about that an hour or so ago, and that came out in the Sir Ollie Robbins appearance last week, that he'd been asked to look into getting a job for Lord Doyle. And Morgan McSweeney was asked about this too. And Emily Thornberry, the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, was, I would say, less than impressed about this.
But have you heard the phrase jobs for the boys? I mean, this is so far from any equal opportunities policies that I've ever heard of. I mean, don't you think this is a little odd or shameful?
Well, the same was true if we had to exit women, senior women from the team as well. We'd have said to them, if you want to stay in government, and some did. But Matthew Doyle. Matthew Doyle would have had... I don't want to...
I'm just saying, yeah. You know, talking about senior women, I mean, what job was she given, for example?
Tsar of the Regent.
Sue Gray's now in the House of Lords. But this isn't about... he wasn't promised a job, and had he applied for the job, then the Foreign Office would have considered his application the same as anyone else.
OK.
Yeah.
So... Not, I mean, in terms of Keir Starmer's position, and I appreciate that Kemi Badenoch has to do something to justify her salary, not a lot changes in the context of this vote later this afternoon as a consequence of anything that Morgan McSweeney has said.
I think that's right, James. I mean, I think we always expected Morgan
McSweeney...
She's
repeatedly misled the House of Commons. What is she actually talking about?
Well, she's talking about those two things of the due
pressure
process
and
the pressure.
Right.
Those are her points. And, of course, you know, we had that clip earlier of Sir Philip Barton when he was asked whether due process was followed, and there was that big pause, and then he didn't or couldn't answer that question. And there have been Labour MPs who've been really felt so uncomfortable with this scandal and how it's played out. But I think you're right. I don't think much of what we've heard this morning has put more pressure on the Prime Minister. But I think that due process answer is probably one of the key things to have come out this morning.
I think you would traditionally wait until this process at Select Committee was complete before deciding whether or not you needed a further level of investigation. But if there is political capital to be made, there is political capital to be made. Who knows what happens later this afternoon, although it will be something of a shock to the system. If Keir Starmer is, if he does lose this vote, that will happen later today.
Great stuff, Aggie Chambray. Thank you very much indeed. 12:45 is the time. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC, and the Mayor of London is up next.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
The Prime Minister tells his MPs a sleaze inquiry into Mandelson's appointment is a stunt. The aide who encouraged it says, my bad. All smiles so far for the King in Washington and what to do with BP's profits.
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
The following is from TfL.
My name was Luna, like the moon. I was 2 days short of my 17th birthday when I was killed. My killer wasn't a bad man. He'd had a rescue dog called Frank and rang his mum every Sunday. He wasn't a speed freak. He just thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit. But that was enough to knock me off my bike and kill me.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
Next.
Hi, just these, thanks. Do you do cashback?
Just need to check you're not a robot first. New security policy.
Okay.
How many traffic lights can you see out the window?
Oh, 2.
No, that's wrong.
Right, well, obviously I'm not a robot.
That's what a robot would say.
What a load of malarkey. Smarty keeps things simple, like 80 gigabytes for £10. And on a rolling monthly SIM plan, you're free to leave any time. Less malarkey, more Smarty. Search Smarty Mobile.
Ready for a new kitchen? Find the one at Wix. With kitchens for first homes and forever homes too. Visit Wix today.
Check your retirement savings are on track with PensionBee's easy-to-use app. Because when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. When investing, your capital is at risk.
With up to £3,000 every year towards career growth at Amazon, I started in the warehouse, knowing I could train in things like coding or robotics. It turns my job into a career. So it means I can be who I want to be, even if I haven't quite decided who that is yet.
Amazon. Opening doors with up to £3,000 every year towards career growth. Eligibility conditions about type and duration of employment apply.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall. Proud partner of Team GB.
It's 12:48. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. The Mayor of London is in Madrid for an artificial intelligence summit, and we will turn our attention to that imminently. But before we do, an arguably slightly bigger story in the news at the moment, Sadiq Khan, is the King's visit to Donald Trump. As one of the American president's most tireless chroniclers and critics, do you think this trip should have gone ahead?
I do. I mean, look, good afternoon. Look, we're celebrating this year 250 years of American independence. Park for a second, King Charles's third forefathers and how they felt about the independence 250 years ago. But he's arguably the best diplomat in the world. The relationship we have with the USA is enduring and I hope long-standing. It's not about personalities, who the current president is, but also the events of the last few weeks, what's happening in Iran, what's happening in the Middle East, us trying to put pressure on President Trump to support us in terms of Ukraine, shows the ties with America in terms of defense, in terms of military, in terms of our security are really important. And King Charles III is, you know, is important. He's doing this. And he's, as I would say, taking one for the team.
On a personal note, are you relieved that the conversations are going to be had in private rather than in front of the world's television cameras because of fears that Donald Trump might say something deeply inappropriate about, I don't know, off the top of my head, you?
The office of President of the United States of America is one where you are a statesman. I'm afraid the way President Trump has conducted himself in the White House is not very statesman-like. His behavior towards a war hero, President Zelensky, his behavior towards other world leaders embarrasses American friends I have, not just politicians and business people, but ordinary Americans as well. And I think had President Trump treated King Charles the way he's treated some others, many of us not just me and progressives wouldn't have forgiven him. So he's done the smart thing in agreeing to this request to speak without, you know, microphones, hot mics or cameras.
You find yourself today warning that London could be hit harder, the London workforce could be hit harder by the impact of artificial intelligence than anywhere else in the country. It's almost as if the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, because yesterday we were talking about how healthy life expectancy in the UK has gone down on average by 2 over the course of the last decade, but it's gone up in London. So, reasons to celebrate, but it only lasted 24 hours because now we're all worried about losing our jobs to AI. Why is London more vulnerable than the rest of the country?
Well, firstly, can I just on yesterday's good news? One of the reasons why London's doing so well when it comes to life expectancy, yes, we've got huge inequalities, is because of lawful migrants coming to London who are healthy, who are fit, who work in the NHS and live long lives, contributing economically, socially and culturally. And so confirming once and for all, they're not a drain on public resources. So you can't have it both ways. On the one hand, people denigrating London for our diversity and lawful migrants. On the other hand, saying, oh, my God, they're living too long. They're not relying upon public services. So it proves the benefits of lawful migration. In relation to AI, look, there are basically three groups of people when it comes to AI. There are AI evangelists. It's all fantastic. Isn't it wonderful? You know, they've got rosy glasses. There are
Tony Blair. I'll put Tony Blair in that category, shall I?
There are AI alarmists. It's all doom and gloom, almost Luddite-like, you know, it's bad. And what I'm trying to be is an AI realist in terms of, look, London has a knowledge-intensive workforce in terms of the jobs we have, entry-level jobs, graduate-level jobs, clerical jobs, white-collar jobs, finance, professional services, public admin. AI, unlike previous huge disruptions, industrialization, cottage industry to factories, globalization, mill towns closing down, factories closing down in mill towns because of cheapest T-shirts made in East and Southeast Asia. This will affect white-collar jobs. And so what I've announced today in my speech at this forum is, firstly, we've set up a task force led by crossbencher, Baroness Martha Lane Fox, which will look at the future of work in London, what we can do to make sure AI helps us rather than hinders us. I'm also announcing today free training for all Londoners in AI, really important. And thirdly, London should be really proud that we are a founder member of the World Cities AI Forum, working together with 10 cities across 5 continents to see what we can do to make sure we use AI to our advantage. And what I'd say to your listeners is, look, in my view, I don't think people's jobs will be replaced by AI. I think people's jobs, if they aren't using AI, will be replaced by those people who do use AI. And that's why I want all Londoners to be skilled up and trained so no one's left behind.
And what will that mean on the ground? Is it going to be in schools? Are people going to be able... What about older people? Are they going to be able to access it?
Great question. So already we're already using AI in London to deal with a number of issues, to do with censoring damp and mould, diagnosing cancer, reducing congestion, live facial recognition, and so forth, so forth. In the private sector, jobs will be changed. If you're, as I was 30, 40 years ago, doing legal research, your job in the future is going to be different. If you're doing public administration work, if you're doing, financial work as a bookkeeper. So we're going to train people so they can use AI to help in their job. We're going to focus on adults because I'm worried about people losing their jobs. The phrase I used in a recent speech is, it could be a weapon of mass job destruction. We need to start early, though. And the good news is the government has seized this and is starting early. I'll give you a simple example, James. If you and I were speaking 10 years ago when I first became mayor, everyone was talking about the importance of learning coding, right? Everyone was learning coding. It's the hottest, ticket in town. AI can now do coding. This job, within 10 years, has been invented and almost made redundant.
That's quite chilling, isn't it? Do you worry about it on a personal level? We've got children of similar ages, and the paths that we thought were opening up for them are closing at a rate of knots at the moment. Might have had an ambition when you were 15 that by the time you're 25 doesn't even exist anymore, or if it does exist, it's been transformed beyond all recognition.
I worry about young people on a more profound level. I think when you look at what social media's done, young people's mental health, online abuse, the rise in disinformation, misinformation, you can now undress women, sexualize women, and so forth. I worry about that on a profound level. In relation to work, I think when you and I left university, you could have one career for life. Now I think you'll have 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 12 careers. I'm not saying jobs, careers within a working life, which I think is both exciting and daunting. And that's why I'm saying, as far as London's concerned, we've got to be ahead of the curve. We've got to have a first mover advantage. I want people to be trained in AI so they're not replaced by AI, but they can use AI to help them do their job. Think about the person who works in a hospital who looks manually at x-rays or, you know, blood tests. That can now be done with AI, so you're checking for accuracy and whether this is working well. I think, by the way, James, in the future, forget diagnosing cancer because of AI. I think we'll find a cure to things like cancer and other illnesses using AI.
Wow. I was going to end by asking you how, when technology is so new, you actually identify the people that are worth listening to, how you actually know who the experts are, given that the technology is both new and moving so quickly. But I've just noticed that my old mate John Amici is on your list, so I don't want to cast aspersions on the wisdom of appointing him to a key role. But the question stands, how do you know who the people, it's an awful lot of people claiming to know everything about AI and making all sorts of predictions. How do you pick your team for a task like this?
Well firstly, he makes even you look short. So not just am I short in his presence, but so is James O'Brien. Great question. So we've made sure we've got a cross-section of people in the task force. Those from the trade union are really important, right? Because they represent workers who could be out of a job because of AI. People like Martha, she set up lastminute.com. For those who are vintage of you and I will know what lastminute.com was, the difference it made rather than going to a travel agent, doing it online. But also people from different sectors as well. We've got a cross-section of people on the task force. I want them to have a realistic view about, you know, map out what the workforce in London is like now, map out what the future of AI is, speak to the, you know, the big tech companies who are developing AI, speak to employers. I was at a recent visit to, you know, for example, Goldman Sachs, and it's fascinating how they're using AI in terms of helping them do their work. The same applies to public services. Look, when money's tight, if you're a council, if you're the mayor, if you're the government, AI can be a game changer in targeting the public services to people who need it the most. I'll give you an example, just a simple example. One of the issues that we've talked about in the past when I've come on Speak to Sadiq with you is people ringing in with damp and mold in their homes. They've got to ring up the council. It takes ages for an inspector to come around. They do a report. A landlord then doesn't take action but serves them a notice to quit. We can have now, we are having now, sensors inside people's homes that detect when damp and mold is there. That lets the council, the landlord know. And by the way, this Labour government's changed the law, so landlords got to take action. They've also said change the law, by the way. A landlord can't serve you a section 21 notice of eviction. So, God willing, we will not have a situation where a two-year-old like Awab Ehsan lost his life in Rochdale because of damp and mold. That's the power if AI is used properly.
I just some breaking news for you. You're probably not aware of, but the an attack upon a memorial wall in Golders Green dedicated to Iranian people who have been killed by that country's regime. I've just been told that counter-terror police are investigating, but that the Met have said the incident is not being treated as terrorism. Officers are keeping an open mind about the motive behind the attack. This would appear to be an attack aimed at Iranian dissidents and indeed victims of the Iranian regime, but the fact that it's taken place in Golders Green, traditionally a very Jewish area of London, will draw a lot of people's attention back to some of the apparently and in some cases obviously anti-Semitic attacks upon properties in the capital. There are some dark forces abroad, Sadiq Khan.
Well, one of the joys of those that don't know Golders Green is you've got a London population of Jewish faith, Jewish background, but also living cheek by jowl with a population of Iranian heritage as well, those that fled the Shah, fled the Ayatollah Khomeini when the Shah was deposed in 1978. So these communities really get on. Actually, you're right to remind listeners, over the last 6 weeks, we've had a number of attacks on those who are against the Iranian regime, and our Jewish neighbours, friends and colleagues as well. And the Met Police have been public with this. I'm not bridging confidences. There is a real concern. The phrase used is thugs for hire, paid by supporters of the current Iranian regime. And it's really important, I say this to anyone who's listening who, you know, isn't of Jewish background, Jewish faith, Jewish culture, or of somebody who is anti the Iranian regime. Now is the opportunity for us to show allyship, friendship, and understanding with how our Jewish friends and neighbours are feeling. There is a heightened fear amongst Jewish Londoners, Jewish people across the globe, And we've got to show them solidarity. We've got to ask them how they are, visit a synagogue, break bread with Jewish friends and neighbors because they're frightened. And actually, events over the last 6 weeks show there were every reason to be frightened. We've got to be good Londoners, good Brits, and show them some love.
Sadiq Khan, Mayor of London, speaking to us live from Madrid. Thank you very much indeed. I'd echo certainly the final piece of the Mayor's comments as well. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the LBC app, where you can also stay up to date with all the latest news, videos and opinion. You can listen to a range of podcasts, including James O'Brien Daily, the best bits from my show every day. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Tom Sawbury, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much, James. Have a lovely afternoon. Three today are BP's profits, a war windfall. Two, all smiles so far on the state visit to the US garden party. Tick. Afternoon tea with King. Tick. The King addressing Congress later on during Ian Dale's time on air. He'll join me at two to talk about the show so far. That show, the Washington show so far. But we're going to start in the House of Commons. MPs are beginning a debate on whether to launch an inquiry into whether or not Keir Starmer has misled Parliament over his appointment of and the vetting process of Peter Mandelson. Yes, still talking about Peter Mandelson. We'll get the latest on it all from Lewis Goodall. We'll also reflect on some evidence being given to Parliament this morning by Morgan McSweeney and another senior civil servant.
On your radio, on the LBC app and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the former number 10 chief of staff has insisted that his team didn't put pressure on the Foreign Office to approve Lord Mandelson's vetting.
Yes, we wanted it done quickly, but at no point in number 10 did I witness anyone being dismissive about DV or national security.
Morgan McSweeney's told MPs examining the process and looking at claims the Prime Minister didn't know for months about the peer's failed security checks that his motive was always the national interest. A debate started in the Commons ahead of a vote on whether the Prime Minister should face a parliamentary investigation. The Tory leaders accusing him of misleading the Commons when he said due process was followed for Lord Mandelson's appointment as ambassador to Washington. Kemi Badenoch is unhappy that Labour MPs have been ordered to vote against an investigation.
If Labour MPs allow the whips to force them to block the consequences of these decisions, it will degrade not just them, but this House. Yeah. The question is, what kind of people are they? Are they people who will live up to the promises they made about standards and the rules mattering, or are they people who abandon their promises to be complicit in a cover-up?
Yeah. Number 10's accusing the Tories of a desperate political stunt. The King and Queen will head to a ceremonial welcome with the Trumps in the next hour as they start the first full day of their US state visit. Charles will also address the US Congress later. Counter-terror police are looking into a suspected arson attack on a memorial wall in Golders Green, an area of North London with a large Jewish community. The police say it will heighten concerns in an area where local people have already faced a series of attacks. Separately, two men arrested after the discovery of items close to the Israeli embassy in London have been freed from police custody. One has been bailed, the other released without charge. The mother of a murdered teenage girl says Britain can learn from Australia's social media ban for children. Esther Jai says UK restrictions could be made more effective than those down under, as ministers confirm they'll bring in some kind of age or functionality limits. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 5 points at 10.326. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather. Cloud clearing to leave a sunny afternoon for most. A few showers for the southwest and northern isles. Feeling cooler. Highs of 11 to 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Matt Hewitt.
You know what you're getting with a conference. Laptop backpacks. Security pass lanyard.
If you could just pop this on.
Being asked, how was your journey in?
How was your journey in?
An array of triangular sandwiches. Having to deal with a small crisis back at the office. Sometimes in life, you just know what you're getting. Like a great night's sleep and a tasty breakfast. You know what you're getting with Premier Inn.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello, good afternoon to you. There is a lot going on. Lewis Goodall is here in the studio with me. You'll hear from him in just a few moments to help us walk through and talk through all that is going on. It's been a busy morning in Parliament. Right now, the Leader of the Opposition is on her feet at the start of a debate into whether or not the Prime Minister has been guilty of sleaze. She wants an investigation into that. There will be a vote on whether that investigation happens or not later this evening around 7 o'clock. Stay with LBC throughout the afternoon for all of that. But at the same time, over in a different part of Parliament, there have been yet more questions put to both former civil servants and Morgan McSweeney, the Prime Minister's former closest advisor, all around the appointment of and vetting of Peter Mandelson. And that's what this debate in the Commons is about as well. So let's go back and re-establish what this story actually is, that the narrative of it all, so that we can all keep up, because it is quite complex and has an awful lot of threads to it. A week ago, former permanent Undersecretary of State for Foreign Affairs, Ollie Robbins, said he had felt pressure from Number 10 to approve Peter Mandelson as ambassador.
I'm afraid I walked into a situation in which there was already a very, very strong expectation, and you will have seen the papers released already under the humble address, that coming from Number 10, that he needed to be in post and in America as quickly as humanly possible. The very first formal communication of this to my predecessor from Number 10 private office being that they wanted all this done at pace and Mandelson in post before inauguration.
Well, this morning, his predecessor, as he mentioned, a man called Philip Barton, said this about pressure.
During my tenure, I was not aware of any pressure on the substance of the Mandelson DV case. Question two, was there pressure? Absolutely. And I've described it, and I also have seen what the Foreign Office said to you last night, and recognise what is said in that letter about the pressure to get it done, i.e. DV clearance, by a particular timescale.
Now, after his grilling by the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, former Downing Street Chief of Staff Morgan McSweeney, sort of a second skin until recently to Keir Starmer, he resigned in February of this year following taking responsibility, essentially, for Peter Mandelson's appointment. He was speaking earlier this morning and this lunchtime being questioned by MPs. This was his opening statement, though.
The appointment of Mandelson as ambassador was a serious error of judgment. I advised the Prime Minister in support of that appointment, and I was wrong to do so. As I said in my resignation statement, I resigned because I believe responsibility should rest with those who make serious mistakes. Accountability in public life cannot apply only when it is convenient. The Prime Minister relied on my advice, and I got it wrong. It is also important, however, to distinguish between what I did do and what I did not do. What I did do was make a recommendation based on my judgment that Mandelson's experience, relationships and political skills could serve the national interest in Washington at an important moment. That judgment was a mistake. What I did not do was oversee national security vetting, ask officials to ignore procedures, request that steps should be skipped, or communicate explicitly or implicitly